For June the 27th, 2014, we talk about BioShock Infinite in a very special bonus level.
The world could show nothing to me, so what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
My name is Cole Ross.
I'm Dennis Furia.
I'm David Kleinsmith.
I am Gary Butterfield.
I'm Ben Merkel.
And you're listening to The Level, more particularly a bonus level about BioShock Infinite. And as you heard, we are joined by a panoply, is that the right word? An abundance, an excessive amount of guests, by which I mean one more than usual. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Yeah. We have formed a gestalt.
Yes.
We're boring Voltron, go!
Yeah. So as promised, we're doing the usual bonus level treatment after after a year's hiatus as regards Spec Ops: The Line and Gone Home. We're here to talk about these things. And Dennis, can you tell us a little bit about what we have in store at the beginning here?
Yeah. So we had the distinct pleasure of having Adrian Murphy on the show, who was a senior producer for the game. And I don't know how exactly we're going to cut that interview in. It'll be, you know, editing weirdness, go.
Oh, we'll know.
But what's that?
We'll know.
Yeah,
it probably won't be that weird.
Here's the interview now.
Every other thing we say.
Cole introduces some backmasking into the podcast.
It's going on right now.
Yeah. So we had a wonderful interview with him. And then we will kind of get into the game proper and mm-hmm. give it kind of the book club treatment as you've seen on other podcasts on the network. Yeah. With some distinct level flair. So
yeah. For sure. So outlining the spoiler policy, we will assume that you have played all of BioShock Infinite. So nothing is sacred right now. We're gonna kind of walk through the story beats. It is your own fault if you stick around. Next week, there's going to be an episode about Burial at Sea. We're going to try to keep the actual main episode a little bit clear of that. But, some stuff's going to slip out. If you have not played Burial at Sea, consider yourself warned, but we will try. Did I miss anything there, guys?
Let's do this.
Yeah. So you're going to hear probably about 45 minutes of interview with Mr. Adrian. And we're going to come back with our own little thing. 3, 2, 1.
All right, so now we are joined by Adrian Murphy, senior producer of BioShock Infinite. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's exciting to talk to you about this game that we've all played and all enjoyed, and we're going to spend about 3 hours after we're done talking to you, kind of taking it apart. I wanted to kind of start and just give you a chance to introduce yourself, and then talk a little bit about what your role was in creating BioShock Infinite.
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Adrian. Like you mentioned, I was the senior producer. My role was basically the job of production, as I saw it, was to support the development team. So, you know, traditionally producers handle schedules and meetings and all that kind of stuff. But basically, the job of the production department at Irrational was to make sure everybody on the development floor had what they needed to be successful. So that meant making sure information was flowing properly, making sure people had the right equipment, making sure people weren't blocked in any way, and we were following up when they needed review or they needed clarification or direction. So it was a lot of, you know, kind of facilitating the flow of communication for everyone to make sure that people felt like they were in a position to be successful.
Nice. So would you say you kind of had your hands in a lot of different parts of this game? Did you have a very eagle's eye view?
Yeah, I would say I had my eye on a lot of parts of the game. I wouldn't say hands in it, because I think producers are one of those roles where when it's going really well, people kind of wonder in the development studio what they do. We don't create any content directly for the game, but we make sure that everyone there is able to create the best content possible and focus just on that and not on anything that they feel like they need to be successful. So, it's nice getting to see the game from a very, like you said, bird's eye view, and helping everyone make it as good as can be.
Yeah.
So as you're watching things come together, does it kind of, you know, does a lot happen up front and then it kind of trails off and a lot happens at the end? Or what's kind of the level of activity through different parts of creating the game?
It's varied. The level of activity in terms of contribution, I think, is always high in a development studio, especially when you're working on a title as big as Infinite was. I think in terms of actually seeing the game come together, it's, you know, I've worked on three different games now, and that's my experience has always been, it's sort of this, like, you'll see snippets of things that are starting to look cool, but they're really disjointed, and then as you get really close to the end, this momentum will just build extremely fast, and all of a sudden you'll be like, whoa, we have a whole game, and then you'll be like, whoa, we have an awesome game. And that's when it really gets exciting to me, is that sort of kind of closeout phase of development where everything starts coming together and the gray area just very quickly starts melting away and everybody is now focused just on the polish of the experience. There's no more questions left to be answered.
Nice.
Yeah. So could you go into that a little bit more as far as what's the timeline of production like? Do you guys start – did you have the story like first day when you started making the game, or did that develop concurrently?
That developed a long way. I actually wasn't there when they first started. I joined Irrational in 2010. That was shortly before, they did the reveal event, the very first one in New York. And the story was starting to come together at that point. And I think there was a general idea of what it was, but it evolved over the course of development. And that was not by virtue of the fact that I think we didn't know what we wanted to do, but more, I think when I first got there, Ken had me read a book called On Writing by Stephen King.
I love that book.
Yeah, great book.
Read it as well. Great book.
Yeah, great book. Great biography just in general, but also I like the chapters interspersed about the process. And I think the one that stuck with me the most and helped me kind of understand the culture of Irrational and how they get to the quality bar that they do is he sort of talks about, like, as you're writing a story, the characters reveal themselves to you. And I never understood that concept until the making of Infinite, where I sort of watched as time went by. We started to figure out who Booker was. We started to figure out who Elizabeth was. We started to figure out the world and the environments and the stories to be told in each individual space. So there's a general idea of what kind of the major plot points of the story are going to be, but those small moments that really resonate with people, those are the kind of things that evolve over the course of development. And it's not until you sort of take your first stab at it and make something and go play it that you say, like, that's not really what we wanted it to be, but now we kind of see where we want to go with it.
So did you have to, from a production standpoint, you know, be prepared for when you have those insights in the middle of creation in the course of making this stuff happen to be able to say, yeah, we kind of have to upset this and go back and make a change or respond to this? Like, how adaptive did you have to be?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was at Irrational more so than any other studio I've been at, one of the big challenges in production, but also one of the most rewarding facets of it was trying to, you know, have a plan in place that helps the team kind of continue making progress and make sure that everyone is focusing on what is best for the game. But at the same right, understanding that at any given time, you could throw parts of it out the window, not because you just want to upend the table for the sake of it, but because, okay, we've realized that there's a better way to approach this and we're going to need to go back to the drawing board and just figure out what are the changes we need to make? What are the low-cost changes? What are the high-cost changes? How do we, you know, figure out where that work lands now? But there was a lot of work to be done in terms of figuring out how we would kind of rebalance the workload. There was never really any debate at all about was it the right thing to do, because we could always see that it was done in the interest of making the game better. And that was, I think, one of the things I really treasured about Irrational was you hear a lot of studios talk about, like, yeah, we'll throw stuff out if it's not good enough, or like, we won't stop until we get it right and it's done when it's done. And that was the only place I've ever seen or heard of that really stuck to that mantra and really, you know, kind of when the rubber met the road, was willing to say, like, this isn't good enough. We need to spend more time to make it better. We're going to figure out how to do that.
What were some of the elements that were there any parts of the game that, you know, you wanted to include and just, you know, ran out of time, or, you know, for some other reason just end up kind of on the cutting board floor? Any, you know, in terms of, you know, mechanics, story, anything like that?
No, not really. I mean, there were definitely parts of the game that didn't get past the cutting room floor, but none of them were ever done in the interest of time. And I think it's – I feel unfortunate for Ken because I think he gets a lot of flack about, you know – why wasn't this in the game or why wasn't that in the game when he tells stories about what was cut or like was this just moved to DLC. And, you know, no DLC was started before the end of Infinite's development was done. Like, not a single drop of it. Everything that didn't make the game didn't make it because it wasn't right for it. Things we cut out were this scene no longer makes sense. This level runs on a bit too long to try to tell the story that we wanted to. You know, this encounter doesn't feel right, or it just doesn't make sense in terms of the overall narrative. And that's one of those things where, you know, we talked just a minute ago about when you throw out work because you know that one individual scene needs to be better, but there's also a ripple effect of like, okay, does it now make sense in context of the other scenes that were bookending it or other parts of the story that it touched on? And sometimes that stuff gets cut just by virtue of the fact that one thing evolves somewhere else and you still want to make sure it's kind of a cohesive narrative and a cohesive experience all the way across. So yes, there were things that didn't make the game, but no, they never made it just because we ran out of time. They were all conscious choices for the quality of the product.
Were there any instances where you had something or examples of things that you started with and you're like, oh, this is going to be a slam dunk home run, and you started it and you're like, oh, this isn't working out. We gotta change.
Yeah, I think for anyone who wants to look them up, Sean Robertson, the animation director, and John Abercrombie, the lead gameplay programmer, I think both gave talks on Elizabeth at the most recent GDC. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the examples they used that really resonated within the team about this need for iteration and you won't kind of know what the changes are until they're revealed to you is that first scene in Boardwalk when you wake up after you've rescued Liz from the tower. I'm going to assume anybody listening has played. So spoilers. At some point, you are accompanied by Liz in a game about Elizabeth. Yeah. So you land on that beach and then you have that wake up scene and she runs ahead and you sort of have a moment to explore the beach by yourself and then you come around the corner and you find her dancing, and that's sort of a key scene because it's the first time Elizabeth has ever been out of her tower. Like, everything is great to her. She's inquisitive about everything. And we sort of use that as a test bed, that area before you go up and meet the Lutesses to pick a locket of when we were developing Liz, that was the AI test bed for her. That was like, okay, let's see, can we make her look good in this environment? Because this environment has everything. It has people to interact with. It has spaces you can go as a player. It has spaces she can go. It has things you can do that can trip her up. So we worked out a lot of different problems there in terms of her development, her behaviors, her pathing, her interactions with the world. It was just a great space to test. But I think one thing that we thought is, okay, you know, the first stab at Elizabeth was, okay, she's been in a tower her whole life. She's going to be really naive. So in this space, she's going to have a sense of wonderment about everything. And we recorded all the lines. We did all the animations. That area of the level was basically up to a shipping quality. And then we played it, and everyone in the studio unanimously was like, God, Liz just sounds like an idiot. Like, she's like, what is cotton candy? What is this? What is a beach ball? And it was one of those things that sounded so good in theory. And then when you actually played it, you're like, no one is going to be endearing to someone who's never even read a book about what cotton candy is. So he sort of had to go back to the drawing board and say, like, all right, Liz is that that was one of those things about the characters revealing themselves is the dichotomy between Liz and Booker was Booker is street smart, Liz is book smart. So she spent a lot of time in her tower reading about the outside world and studying it, but she hasn't experienced it. So it sort of went through, you know, an iteration to the point where Liz was now very knowledgeable about all these elements. She'd just never seen them before in real life. And that's why when you go through the game, you'll often get moments where Liz is giving you background information on the area you're in or the historical significance of the characters that you're interacting with. I think a great example is later in that level, you know, with Slade and everything that's going on in the Hall of Heroes. She's telling her version of it as she knows it. Booker's talking about the version that he actually lived because he's seen that it's being propagandized, and she only knows what she read in the books. Mm-hmm. But Liz didn't used to be like that. She used to be basically someone that needed everything explained to her, and we, you know, thought that was the character, and then as soon as we did it, we're like, wow, this just cannot stand. We all know we have to throw all this VO out and all these animations out and start over with that to get her right.
You can't grow up in a tower without watching Ken Burns' Cotton Candy.
Yeah. That's weird because, like, essentially what she would be doing, she would be serving as exposition for stuff that you already knew as the player.
Right.
Right.
Like, right. Ooh. And then in the absence of that, we were basically, all right, Booker has a mechanic to talk when we need him to narratively, but unless we're going to put in a button where he can basically, you know, mouse over everything and explain to Liz what this thing is with canned VO, we can't have her be completely devoid of knowledge of the outside world. Because then we're basically saying, you know, she lived in the tower. There was no books. There was no library that you found her in. Songbird never brought her anything from the outside world. And now she's basically Plato's man in a cave, which is an interesting philosophical argument, but not probably a very interesting character to go on a journey with for 12 hours.
And that was the fourth DLC, BioShock. What is this thing?
I heard at one point there was
a C.
I heard at one point there was an idea to have Booker not say any lines at all and Elizabeth be the only character who talks.
It was actually the reverse of that. It was Liz never said anything. If you watch that animation talk by Sean Robertson at GDC, he gave a whole part of that where when they first started developing, and this is before my time, so I'm just going by the stories. When they first started developing Liz, they thought they were really clever. They were like, all right, we'll have her not talk, so we don't have to worry about writing any VO, and she'll express everything through animation. And he's got some great videos of some really early kind of Gibson Girl version of Liz when they were in the Nouveau style, trying to basically just express things through animation only. And they did keyframe tests, they did mocap tests, and it sort of became apparent very quickly to everyone there that for the player to have a true emotional connection with her, they're going to have to be able to communicate with her back and forth, and she's going to have to speak and have a voice, because otherwise it's going to feel like kind of a hollow gimmick that wears off very fast when she's just miming the entire time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the version of the game where her tongue got cut off in a tear.
Yeah. So, well, technically that version exists somewhere in the spectrum. So
that's gross. Yeah. It's like she's trying to kiss somebody as she's being taken out. Like, yeah.
She's it's impression. Dark.
Yeah. That's the fifth piece of DLC, BioShock Nell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of along that there, you know, you talked about some of the criticism, you know, or just the general ambient criticism that gamers tend to lobby. Well, was this DLC or whatever, you know, but something that, you know, generally comes up when talking about this game is kind of how incongruous the violence is with, you know, kind of the loftier nature of the story, Booker's bloody past aside, you know, specifically in terms of like the Skyhook killings and stuff like that, you know. Can you tell me a little bit about the conversation that went on internally about how to handle, you know, the level of violence that ultimately, you know, ended up inside the game?
Yeah. I mean, that was a funny thing to watch when the reviews kind of first came out and the term ludonarrative dissonance became like the new catchphrase for every gaming website in the world. There were discussions we had, but not to the level that I think anyone had that kind of discourse after the game was released. Mm-hmm. We'd always looked at it as, you know, Booker is an anti-hero. He is not a good person. He did some very shitty things in his life, as you find out when you play the game. He's a Pinkerton. Pinkertons, you know, were known for being pretty ruthless strike breakers when they were employed. So it didn't really strike us as strange that Booker was doing these violent things or being a violent person, because that was very much within his character. And, you know, also, that was another great kind of development story about Liz, was before you got all the final touches on her where she would have reaction emotions and animations to seeing you actually do something, you would basically like saw a guy's head off with a skyhook and she would just stand there and be like, all right, cool. or like, wow, you saved me there, Booker. And it's just like that didn't fit at all. So we needed sort of that shock reaction. And to some extent, I think something that doesn't really get mentioned and maybe it's just me and maybe it's me being defensive about the game, but I always thought that that topic came up because we actually did a very good job with selling the horror to Liz of what Booker was doing. Like Liz starts the game very afraid of Booker, and by the end of it, she's completely desensitized to it. And that's sort of, you know, a commentary on how violent the game is in general. But I also think that by people seeing Liz react that way, it sort of spurned the argument in their head of like, yeah, why is this game so violent? And I kind of take it as a mark of pride that we were able to have Liz mirror what people might have been thinking to the point that they actually felt the need to bring it up. The other thing is, I think people were looking for that game to be a couple different things, and some folks wanted it just to be the kind of walking around in a beautiful world simulator. Some people wanted it to be the shooter. Some people wanted it to be the companion story, and I think it does an admirable job of being all of those things at once. But, you know, if someone doesn't want it to be the violent game, they're obviously going to bring up the violent aspect to it. And I think it's, again, something that played really well on the dichotomy of the game, which you saw this beautiful world of Colombia and, you know, everything you saw in the opening level in Town Center. And then it's juxtaposed very quickly with that violence. But that was the reality of Colombia. Like, Colombia was a violent place. You know, they were employing basically slave labor to keep the city up and going. Fink was mistreating people to the point of, you know, death. Mm-hmm. In his factory. And that's you were doing the same thing that was happening in that world. You were just doing in a more graphic first person way. So I don't really think Booker was sort of this weird kind of anomaly in the world of Columbia.
Yeah.
Sure. Was that I noticed that some of the propaganda that you overhear, a lot of it tended to serve as commentary on some of that, and, you know, your actions. Was that intentional? Was that meant to be used to kind of advance that idea?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think some of the commentary you'll hear is used to give you a better idea of the world itself. Some of it is used to give you the sense that things you're doing are actually affecting the world. I think, you know, there's that great moment in Boardwalk right after you get the locket from the Lutesses where everyone looks at the tower and comments on why it's fallen down and what's happened to it. And you as the player obviously know the story behind that, but you also get the sense that you didn't just go through this huge destructive sequence in the first part of town and then you got to a beach and everyone's just having cotton candy and is completely, you know, oblivious to the fact that part of their city is falling out of the sky.
Sure.
So, you know, I think yes, it's always done to sort of add some characterization to the world around you, be it to give you a better background on the environment you're in or to give you a sense of you being an active participant in this world. But something that, you know, we would always say at Irrational that I think everyone is really good about hearing to is it, no matter where you are, every single place needs to tell a story. And I think that's why you'll see so many great small scenes that might have no acting characters, no, you know, interaction between Booker and Liz. It's just some objects placed in the environment and an audio log or some propaganda around that'll just kind of give you a sense of what's happening in that world. And it's for you to sort of find that story.
Yeah.
Okay, kind of zooming out just a little bit as opposed to, you know, thinking about the specifics. And, you know, you talked a little bit about how it changed those plot changed during development. Can you speak at all to how the tone changed a little bit? Because it definitely in the early, you know, concept art and some of that early materials, it seems like this game was a little closer to the original BioShock in terms of horror elements and kind of claustrophobia. And that doesn't, you know, the final product seems to have moved away from that quite a bit. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, somewhat. Again, this is sort of, it's just broaching on the time that I got there, so I kind of came in for the tail end of that transformation, but I think when you look at the really early previous videos that are online, you'll see it looks much darker, it looks much kind of more survival horror-y, it looks a bit more claustrophobic, like you mentioned, in some of the spaces, and I think that's just, you know, sort of when the team was prototyping what it was going to be, they started closer to what they knew, and what they knew was Rapture and that world from BioShock. But I think as that story kind of evolved and as that world kind of evolved, so too did everything around it. And it became sort of that perfect summer day, bright blue skies, everybody having a great time in a perfectly open sky city. And the juxtaposition really sort of started to reveal itself. And I know that one of the books that everyone read, because it was one of the really great inspirational pieces, was Devil in the White City, which is about the 1893 exposition in Chicago. And that is sort of a great mirror of what Infinite ended up being, and I think helped informed a lot of the world of Columbia, where it's this bright, open, white stucco, beautiful world that everyone's seen, and inside of it there's this series of, you know, killings happening. And that sort of helped inform the world of what Columbia was supposed to be. It was supposed to be sort of a World's Fair idea, which is, you know, Rapture was its own thing, and it was all about, you know, personal achievement and the power of the individual. Columbia was really about the power of the country. It was about what America could do. It was the Ferris wheel of that time. It was, look at how amazing this city is. And then it sort of broke off and became its own thing under Comstock's leadership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think some of the dissonance that people were experiencing was the fact that in BioShock 1 and 2, you were coming to Rapture after the fall, whereas in the original, you know, in BioShock Infinite, you know, you were coming to a place that was very much filled with people who
you know, might well have been innocent. Like, you know, you were actually the agent of the fall in this, you know.
Yeah, I certainly think so. And I think that's an intentional dissonance. I think that was something that the narrative and creative team very much wanted to do, was to tell the story of a city that is in the midst of a civil war, and you can sort of see the genesis of it. And as you mentioned, through the actions that you take, you sort of become the agent of it. So it makes you question, would this have happened had I not been involved in all? And, you know, I think people sort of had preconceived notions, but really, would it have been as good a game if it's just like, yeah, here's another city that you came in after everything's already gone and you're just playing the archaeologist again, as opposed to you're playing an active participant this time around? And yes, I think that could create some dissonance because not everyone is sort of a crazy splicer. And people might have a bit more humanity up front, but I think people who kind of looked a bit deeper in the game saw that really kind of bourgeois privileged class that you saw in the first level of the game is living the life they live, built on the backs of the people you see in Finkton.
Oh,
so,
sure.
You know, these people aren't, they're still splicers in a sense. They're not overt monsters who are just trying to bash your face in, but they're also not like ethically pure people either. There is some evil in them. It's just manifesting in different ways.
Yeah. Even just in their kind of ambient barks, you know, the things that they say out loud, you know, some of it's exposition, but other parts of it are like, yeah, things are a little bit off here.
Yeah,
I really like the audio log early in the game where they talk about, I think it's Fink is saying to Comstock, how the people wouldn't be okay with the society if they had to work all the time, and that being the inspiration for them getting slaves from Georgia. Because that really shows that, yeah, the people aren't as happy and nice as they appear to be.
But, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of that blissful ignorance, and I think if you look for a parallel between the two, the people in Rapture are ignorant to the fact that the city has fallen down. They're just going around trying to find Adam and remain spliced up, and the people in Columbia are oblivious to the fact that the city is doing fine, but it's doing so based on the backbreaking labor of what is essentially a slave class.
Yeah. What were some of the inspirations for Finkton? Can you cite any of the sources for that?
It all goes back to sort of that time period around the turn of the century and the industrialization of the country. And I think you saw things like the Triangle Factory fire, the working conditions and the labor movement that you saw at the time. And, if you look up any historical evidence on what factory conditions were like during the, you know, late 1800s/early 1900s, it would seem appalling, even in comparison to some of the things we showed in the game. And that's sort of the inspiration, is there was a very real time in America where factories were massively unsafe places staffed by what were essentially immigrant classes, you know, Irish, European classes, and, you know, paid very little, with almost no rights whatsoever before the unions existed, in an environment that would most likely end up killing them just so that the country could expand.
Yeah, it's the parts of the jungle that everybody ignores in favor of the, ooh, meat.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So in terms of some of the inspiration, once the rebellion, actually gets kicked off, you know, can you kind of speak to some of the inspiration of that? Because that seems like that's one area where, you know, we had the labor movement in the states, and, you know, we did have, you know, some violence, but there's never a large scale, you know, class warfare rebellion.
Yeah, that sort of – it becomes a melding. It sort of becomes like you said, it starts with sort of the labor movement and the workers' rights movement, but then very quickly evolves into what is essentially a terrorist group. And that's sort of, I think, what you see in Finkton once the rebellion starts really taking place, is that once Daisy's people and the Vox Populi have taken over, they're not walking around like making everything great for the workers. Like, they're looting and pillaging and killing as well. So there's no really right or wrong group between the founders and the Vox Populi. They're both kind of morally ambiguous groups that just handle the power they have in very different ways. So I think there's no specific inspiration, but I do think you look at it in the sense of this is sort of what it looks like from the perspective of a terrorist group. This is the world they want, and once they get it, all they really know how to do is to tear it down.
Sure.
So I think it's interesting. You talked earlier about how you show up early in kind of the life cycle of this place, and you're more of an active agent in the changes that happen, and a lot of the themes in the game are about choice and about fate and that sort of thing. But the story itself is pretty fixed. Do you know if there was ever kind of an intent to have multiple endings or the story change more drastically based on the choices that you would make in the game?
I don't know, but I wasn't in all the narrative meetings, so maybe there was that never saw the light of day. I can't say for sure, but I can say there wasn't sort of a push to make it a very large forked Mass Effect type experience. Like, no one wanted to really double down on what was done in BioShock, because that made sense for that world and the story they were telling there. Here, it really was more about, you know, yes, there are infinite probabilities, but at the end of the day, they all collapse into a singularity. And that was sort of the story of Infinite, was the singularity of how Booker and Elizabeth's path will always end up playing out. So I think, you know, there might have been discussions about it, but I think it was probably very quickly realized that it didn't make sense in terms of telling a compelling narrative. And not just that, I think when you look at BioShock, the character you play there, it's very much about the choice and how you interact with the world in that choice. Whereas Infinite, I think people instantly look at it as kind of the story of Columbia and Booker's interaction with it, because they compare it to the original BioShock, but really it's the story of Elizabeth and Booker, and you don't want to have kind of branching character choices when you're trying to tell a comparing narrative between two people on a personal level, especially with the backstory that those two have that you actually find out at the end of the game. So I don't think choice would have made much sense in terms of having the same emotional impact when you realize the relationship between Booker and Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense, yeah. So when you played the game, did you choose the bird or the cage?
I chose both because I played it like 100 times. So I did a lot of playing through that scene. I could probably quote the rowboat scene from the beginning of the game by memory. I played it so many times.
It always comes up heads.
Yeah,
he
so
doesn't row.
I would end up ultimately I would probably pick the bird.
Yeah. Were there sensitivities about tying it back into the BioShock continuity, at least in terms of the main game? I know that Burial at Sea, you know, makes it all, you know, let the circle be unbroken, right? But, mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of a little bit of a left turn into, you know, into the very final, you know, 10 minutes of the game. Can you talk about anything that involved in that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there were any real sensitivities to it. I think, you know, it was very intentionally titled BioShock Infinite because it is a basically saying that there are infinite worlds out there, and in these infinite worlds, these stories continually playing out, but there are common elements. There's, you know, Liz says there's always a man, there's always a lighthouse, there's always a city, but there's elements beyond that. If you look at Elizabeth and Songbird, that's your little sister big daddy relationship, or if you look at Elizabeth and Booker, that's your little sister big daddy relationship, and it sort of becomes a triangular one there that causes the conflict between Booker and the Songbird. But I think it's very subtly and kind of subconsciously tied to Rapture the whole way throughout, so making it overt during that sort of third act I don't think really came with any sensitivities within the team, because it made sense with how the story was unfolding and the themes that we've been telling up until that point.
So I had one question about Songbird, since you mentioned it. Could you speak to the development of the Songbird? Because it was it's kind of almost like a bait and switch, where you thought that this was going to be like an epic boss battle, perhaps, but you end up using him at the end and like never really full on fighting him, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was one of those things where I think that was a lingering question for a long time, whereas if there's only one Big Daddy and it is the Songbird, then do you eventually fight that Big Daddy? And I think that wouldn't have made for as interesting of an encounter or an end to that story, because I think, you know, you spend the entire game running from Songbird because he's sort of this invincible god of the sky, and ultimately his Achilles heel, which is foreshadowed when you fall in the water away from him at the beginning of Boardwalk, and then later when you see his actual demise, is water. Like, he can't survive in that environment, so that's sort of another reason why Rapture coming back made sense. But it would have been kind of disingenuous, especially if we talk about a disconnect between the narrative and the gameplay, to say, like, you must always run away from this thing because it's a big evil monster monstrosity you can't possibly fight, except we're somehow going to power him down or power you up during this last boss battle so you can fight him just to feel satisfied. Whereas, you know, that would have felt really silly. It's like, wait, why was I running from the whole game if I could just turn around and shoot him in his weak spot at the end of the game? Whereas I think the combat that you actually have kept very much in line with what Songbird was, which is he is this unstoppable force of nature. He's been pursuing you the entire game. Now you have the opportunity to use that to your advantage.
Yeah. I really appreciate the poetic, you know, efficacy of having the cage set you free.
Yeah.
You know? Thank you, Gary.
No problem.
just poised and waiting.
Yeah.
We installed a piano in his room to have that. So.
Oh.
So, you mentioned, you know, we're kind of discussing, you know, Rapture's kind of return in the DLC, and you mentioned that, you know, none of the DLC was, you know, really developed until after the game. Was it always the plan, though, to, you know, end the story that way and to eventually wrap things back around?
No, not always the plan. I mean, it was one of those things where, you know, when we say none of the DLC was done before the end of the game, that means none of it. Like, we didn't even have an idea of what we wanted to do. It was that same thing about, okay, what are the interesting stories to tell? What are the characters kind of telling us, and what story is revealing itself to us? And I think we came up with what felt like, you know, a really great two-part story to tell with Rapture and sort of play off some of the things that you knew from Infinite, but also as kind of service to the longtime fans of the series, go back to Rapture and sort of play off some of the undertones of that as well and intersperse the two characters and give you a better understanding of how those two worlds are interconnected. And that sort of made for Burial at Sea Part 1 and Part 2, and then Clash in the Clouds, which was just, we found that, you know, we had some really great gameplay systems that didn't always get to be at the forefront because the narrative was driving a lot of the experience. So it made sense to have just kind of a fun DLC where it's like, all right, if you take the narrative reins off, what kind of battles can we have? What does a two handyman fight look like? What does it look like when you have to fight, you know, a handyman, 16 guys, and a Zeppelin all at once? Let's try that. And I think that was sort of the road we went down with the DLC, was saying, what would be fun experiences? What stories do we want to tell? Let's step back from those and see how it makes sense to do that in the context of DLC. And that's how we ended up with the three packs that we had.
Was it hard starting the DLC after killing every character in every dimension except for Elizabeth, possibly?
Yeah, I'm sure it presented a little bit of narrative challenge, but one of the nice things about that infinite possibility is, you know, you leave a lot of kind of open ground to cover when you say, like, okay, we want to resurrect some of these characters, or we want to go back and tell a story with these characters that are seemingly dead, but they're dead in one out of an infinite number of realities. So there's infinity minus one ways in which we can use
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you know, to the quantum stuff, that really scratches a personal itch of mine. Let me say that in a grosser way. No, but it's particularly effective just because it's interesting in a thought experiment kind of way. You mentioned, you know, the Devil in the White City and On Writing in terms of works that really drove the team. Was there anything like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead that was like, okay, you're going to need to understand this quantum shit, you know, that kind of influenced the team?
Well, I mean, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead are definitely one. I think the Lutesses are heavily based off of that dichotomy. There was one, I can't remember the name of it. It's something like The Spinning Wheel, but it was this short story about this guy who basically, when he dreams, what he dreams becomes reality around him, but he never realizes it until he wakes up. And he goes to see this psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist realizes what's happening and sort of tries to harness that power and subtly influence what the guy is dreaming about to remake the world. And it was sort of this, someone is probably going to call in or email you guys with the title of this short story that I can't remember, but it was really great influence because it was just sort of this idea of what would it look like if you woke up and reality was different and everyone just thought that's the way it always was. And that's sort of what you see in sort of those quantum shifts and the realities, the way they change, is sort of putting yourself in the mindset of, like, to everyone, this seems like the way it always is, even if it doesn't seem right to you who's in that world.
Yeah, no, I believe what you're referring to is the Lathe of Heaven.
Yes, the Lathe of Heaven.
Wikipedia, folks. Yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of, you know, finally, you know, something that we always like to ask is, you know, what are you playing? What's good? Do you play games? Is that was that a thing for you before you got your job?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, I play everything. I play a lot of games. Let's see. I just got an Xbox One, so I've been playing Titanfall a lot. Nice. Before that, I beat Dark Souls 2 twice.
Oh, and we have a podcast for you.
Yeah. I was playing New Game Plus Plus, and I got to the part right outside the Executioner's Chariot in New Game Plus Plus, and I saw all those red phantoms that were jumping down from the post, and I was just like, oh, fuck this. This is just like New Game Plus Plus starts trafficking in a level of bullshit that I'm not going to tolerate. And then I'm a lot of the time, just when I have my phone on me, I was playing Threes.
Ooh, yeah.
And then played a ton of XCOM Enemy Unknown on my phone, Enemy Within on my computer. I've beaten that game like 9 times.
Iron Man?
I've done Iron Man, classic Iron Man. I'm trying to get my impossible Iron Man run done, but I keep dying around the 4th month because the jump from classic to impossible is, I think classic is a lot about... Well, there's kind of two rules I live by. Tactically, on normal, cover is cover. On classic, half cover is a lie. And on impossible, full cover is a lie. So basically, you always have to break line of sight. But actually, the trickier part about impossible is it really comes about resource management in the metagame and how you play out the satellites, how you play out your interceptors. And you will rarely ever lose an impossible game by wiping a squad and then not being able to have another mission. You will lose that game by very quickly losing more countries than you can afford to. So classic, you might be able to get away with 15 out of 16 or 16 out of 16 countries at the end of the game. Impossible, you just have to make sure you keep the right 9.
It's a subtle dance keeping South America around until you get the satellites up.
I really don't keep... No, South America I usually let go of pretty quick, because especially, you know, I think in Enemy Within, they did a good job of making South America better for the continent bonuses. But yeah, basically Africa, North America, and Asia, to me, are the three that have the best continent bonuses if you're trying to play a metagame on Iron Man Impossible. So I tend to sort of let Europe and South America fall by the wayside pretty quickly.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've got that game in my drawer next to my TV. I'm going to have to break it back out now.
Oh, yeah. It's so good. And then I thought, to me, you know, Enemy Within was one of the most brilliant. You could call it an expansion, but to me, it was sort of like a plus-plus-plus version of the original game that they somehow managed to keep the meta-narrative and the overall game arc, but added so many systems into an already systems-heavy game that just enhanced it in such amazing ways. The Gene Soldiers and the mechs and the new enemies they added and the Exalt faction were just all brilliant, brilliant additions. I mean, I'm foaming at the mouth for whatever Firaxis does next with that franchise.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, July 2nd, Civ Rev 2. That's what I'm excited about.
Yeah. And then, sorry. So, yeah, other than that, I can't think of anything else I'm playing right now. It's kind of a dry summer. Really not a lot of stuff coming out until later this year, or everything under the sun getting delayed to 2015.
Yeah. It's that awkward new console launch window.
Yeah.
Since you're a fan of XCOM, do you play any board games in addition to video games?
Few.
Okay.
Monopoly and Scrabble, which are just mainstays at the Murphy's household. But in terms of being close to XCOM, I love Settlers of Catan.
Okay.
Yeah. That is a game I play a lot of at work whenever I can, or if I ever go to someone's house or have people over here. I'm like, all right, make sure you bring Settlers of Catan with you and let's play that, because I think that's another one of those brilliant games. It has the same thing XCOM has, which is like, it's probably about like 65-70% strategy and 30% random chance. And what makes it really interesting is the strategic choices you have to make because of the random chance. So, you know, you can sort of have your best laid plans, but if you're not playing with about 3 backup plans in place, then you've already lost that game.
Yeah,
agreed. That's a great game. I would recommend Terra Mystica. You should look that up if you want to go deep. Yeah, it's like Settlers on Crack, but you should check that out.
Considered strategic crack. You know, like a real strategy heavy, you know, kind of crack. That's that good. Requires a lot of thinking.
I was getting tired of regular crack, so strategic crack would be a nice change.
You know, the penalties for strategic crack are so much heavier, it's really not fair.
Yeah, you really do have to think much farther ahead about it.
Yeah.
Now we're delving in. This is just what a normal episode for us is like.
Yeah. See,
that's good. We made it half an hour before it really kind of got into the gutter, so.
Yeah.
It's,
I know. I could never get into Catan. I never understood why I couldn't just like go across the border and take the other guy's sheep.
You would do well in Rapture.
Yeah, you really belong in Rapture, David.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I don't know if there are any other last minute questions and that you guys want to throw out. Other hosts want to throw out.
I did have one question. All the names of the characters in the game seem to be fall at least within the range of piano keys. Was that intentional? There's Booker, Anna Comstock, Daisy, Fink. Yeah.
I don't think it was intentional, but if it was, then someone that was that irrational was thinking on a very, very subtle level to slip that one in there. All right.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. This is an awesome conversation and a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you very much for having me. It was fun talking over it.
Yeah. We'll shoot you a line when it comes out.
Yeah, cool. Absolutely.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, guys. Have a fun time.
So now begins kind of our book club portion of the show, where we're going to kind of go into some of the stuff here. I want to clarify, our opinions don't reflect his and vice versa. So there are some things that didn't pop up in the interview that we're going to talk about here, just in the interest of, you know, talking about things naturally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we want to make that abundantly clear for anybody who's listening that if there are some things that we raise a stink about here, just a matter of, you know, we want to talk about these internally to us and we don't want to bring him into it. So with that in mind, why don't we kind of go into it and talk about BioShock Infinite proper?
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. Yeah. So
it always begins at a lighthouse.
It always begins at a lighthouse. And that's a pretty strong parallel because most people, I mean, you're in a rowboat with some weird twins. You're not, you know, having just suffered a plane crash, but it very much is intended to you know, remind you of that similarity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Am I the only one who didn't catch that parallel until they straight up mention it in the closing like scene?
David,
yes.
I'm going to be honest with you, maybe.
Yeah, probably yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's also funny. I'd seen so much art for Elizabeth around the game before I played it and knew she was such a central focus that I just kind of assumed that the Mrs. Lutess was mm-hmm. Elizabeth. For the entire conversation, which made things very weird. Like, I was like, I know I'm supposed to be developing, or maybe this is a flash forward, and I you know, I probably didn't catch as much of it as I should have because I was trying to puzzle out why Elizabeth was having this weird conversation with this other guy.
Wait a minute, like, this is me and her in the future rowing me to become them? Yeah, so the way we're playing with tenses really leans into how they play with tenses as well. God, I love the Lutesses.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the most like successful things about the game. Like they're very interesting and very kind of scene stealing when they're around. Mm-hmm. In the grand, like thematically, I really love them. It's hard for me to know exactly. Like there's a little bit of motivation stuff that feels weird to me. Like specifically, even this lighthouse thing. Like if they're kind of like who you know they get to. I don't want to. Be somebody who can't see the forest for the trees and stuff, but like the degree of how far they're willing to go always feels a little shifty to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this you know, don't become like this guy corpse that's in the lighthouse. Like, yeah. Does that seem in character with the Lutesses? Because I'm pretty sure that's who had to have done it.
Yeah.
That seems so weird. Like,
yeah,
but they're so fun to watch. Like, they're very engaging.
Yeah.
See, I was disappointed. You know, when the final scene went on. I thought the person in the lighthouse that with the unfortunate head surgery was going to be Comstock. I thought that was what they were like doing the loop de loop around to.
Yeah.
In general, like I don't get what they were doing because like they're also the only characters that ultimately in like the later game, you know, rewriting the you know, timelines and screwing things up, never really get entangled in that.
Because they started out entangled.
They're unstuck in time or what have you, right?
Yeah.
Like they exist outside of time and space in some weird way.
Yeah.
Like they're magic gods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Comstock attempted to murder them by sabotage. Yeah, spoilers, people.
We warned you.
Comstock attempted to murder them by sabotaging their machine, and instead of killing them, it scattered them across dimensions.
Yeah.
I think you get that from like a Voxophone. So they're in this like godlike state where they can do whatever they want, and I almost get the sense that they're not really trying to right some big wrong. They're just kind of dicking around.
Well, one of them is. One of them is definitely trying to right a big wrong. The you know, Robert Lutes, the
male
one.
What is he trying to right? Because I got some of the Voxophones, but not all of them. I think I missed some of the important ones.
Grabnab and Elizabeth. Like kidnapping Elizabeth from, you know, dimension A to give to Comstock is what he's trying to. So like the way the grand plot, and this isn't quite the beat by beat thing we have laid out in the notes, but
that's fine.
Let's cut to the chase, guys. Like, as I understand it, is like, that's why, you know, he brings Booker in, and that's why it's so weird that there's a, you know, headless corpse in the thing and all of these kind of acts of manipulation. Mm-hmm. There's a specific point I'll talk about in the DLC next week. Seems so weirdly out of character for the Lutesses.
Yeah.
You know, like, they are monsters.
Oh yeah,
like they are like, they are awful.
Like they are pragmatists on a multi-world level.
Yeah, they're Q.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, like they're Qs, which is like, it's so fun to watch them. And like, I love Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead. Mm-hmm. And seeing that kind of, you know, that reference in the first couple of minutes of this game, like, it was a huge, you know, light bulb over my head, like, mm-hmm. just, oh yeah, you know, that's great.
Yeah.
But it's in like a story sense, I feel like their motivations are weird. Like, mm-hmm. as characters, I don't think they work, you know, like, I just think that they are interesting, like but they are not consistent in a way, you know, or there's not enough information to kind of fill out and make them, it's not even relatable. It's not even the word I mean, like, complete.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the hand wave that I gave to that was like, oh, they are infinitely powerful and have, you know, infinite worlds to experiment with. So, like I said, they're just kind of dicking around, and, you know, it doesn't really matter to them if they screwed up this time, because they'll be able to come right back around to it next time, and they can destroy things and be monsters, and, you know, it all comes out in the wash for them, which again makes it really hard to relate to them.
I think that a lot of it has to do with the limited frame that you have to reference for them. Like, for a lot of these, like, for the majority of people who are not going to go after all of the Voxophones, they're not really going to learn what's happening. And right here, especially at this moment, you know, they just kind of seem like these real quirky characters who are talking in riddles around you. And it's not until they start popping up later, and definitely not until Emporia, where they, you know, start revealing themselves as, you know, integral to the plot, in fact being the entire driving force behind it.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, like, at this point in act one I felt that about the characters.
Definitely
I'm
but
saying,
I mean,
on the long view, now that I've done the entire work, mm-hmm. I feel that way about the characters.
Definitely. And I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, in terms of that limited frame, like, there's just not enough said about them, and a lot of it has to be inferred, and in that space between what is said and kind of maybe what is meant or what we would find satisfying, that's where the kind of disappointment comes from for what they're doing, right?
See, and I guess maybe I would say I didn't read them as quite so overtly malevolent. I don't know. It came across to me overall more that they just weren't ever that the writers never intended to explain them. I mean, that was kind of my...
I think so, too. Like, I don't think that there's a hidden Lutes backstory that we don't know.
Oh,
I just think that how that fits into a larger, like, on a real storytelling kind of basics level, mm-hmm. like, it's not doing very much for the story. Like, at worst, it's kind of like a Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
You know, it is literally just, here are some god cues to, like, set the plot into motion and make anything happen that we need to have happen. Like, it, you know, and there's just a lot of hand waving required. Like, I don't think that there is a secret, you know, it exists. I don't think the developers ever, or the writers ever intended to explain them. I think that's part of their charm at the same time, while being something I kind of feel narratively is unsound.
And I guess what I'm saying, sort of, is, to me, the fact that they're just a Deus Ex Machina is the entire point. is that to me seems entirely consistent with the story, which is to a certain degree that there's, you know, this kind of balance between the ultimate, you know, the infinite timelines, but also this sort of predestined determinism. So I guess to me, I just assumed that was the point, was that they were supposed to be just Deus Ex Machina.
Ben, it sounded like you had something to say.
Yeah, I just interpreted them as scientists, basically. So, like, from the get-go, where they ask you to call the coin flip, and they have a chalkboard that says, like, the number of times that they've tested this before, and how it's always come out as a constant of heads, you know? And so I just kind of interpreted them as just kind of experimenting on Booker and seeing how he would handle the situation in this dimension. And, like, the ways of them, like, sending him a telegram or, like, giving him a shield or something, I just saw that as ways of them just trying to mess with the experiment. I guess he wasn't the control or whatever, but that's how I interpreted them mostly.
Yeah.
Constants and variables.
Yeah.
Do they ever explicitly say, I've seen, you know, I was searching online, you know, getting some of an idea of what some people were talking about. And it seems like there's something of an idea that the part of the point of the heads flip was to, be an early foreshadowing of in kind of the post-apocalyptic, you know, Boys of Silence arc, how many times Booker has failed to get past Songbird.
112. The cycle's gone through 112 times.
Yeah, that's okay, definitely so they the number
do
it, of, yeah.
They do eventually directly reference that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What's great about these characters and kind of carrying on into this about them more generally is the differences between them, even though they are effectively the same person, you know, just like what's the difference between us? One chromosome is the difference between those two in terms of, you know, Robert is the optimist and he's kind of the more jokey, you know, fun loving one. Whereas Rosalind, who kind of is the prime version of Lutess, is kind of more the scientist, more the amoral one. And even though Robert was the one who committed the greater sin by, you know, working with Comstock to take Anna, Rosalind, or, you know, he was also the one, Robert was the one who, you know, goaded them into getting involved with Booker and starting this experiment to try and take these 112 shots at setting things right. Yeah.
And that ties into all of the theming of the game.
Oh, for
like
sure.
Like the idea that, you know, you can be a person and then one thing can kind of set you and make you an entirely different person, you know, and that's the, you know, that's like our consistent theme.
Yeah.
But, so it ties in for that, for sure.
But it doesn't square with the fact that, you know, Robert just straight up beheaded a dude who I only assume was sent to assassinate Booker, because Comstock has, you know, access to the same information they have with the Lutess machine. So I can't take the lighthearted whimsy and finishing each other's sentences along with just the abject creepiness of this lighthouse. Like,
alternate
this is the
interpretation.
Go ahead.
Alternate interpretation to this. Given the note on the front of the lighthouse, these could be memories that Booker is just making up, since he has just been taken to another dimension.
Well, yeah, just going through things, like, how weird is it? So, like, one of the things they introduce is this whole idea that, like, what happens to someone when they transfer dimensions, or when they're dead in the prime dimension or what have you? It's such a frustrating, inconsistent thing in this game. Like, yeah. Booker doesn't really, like, Booker is totally different by the end. None of the people, like, in the interview a little bit, when Adrian was talking about Fitzroy and how the revolutionary, this is what the revolutionaries would do with their power. These aren't the same revolutionaries. Like, who even knows what's going on in that world? You know, like, this, the game is constantly clearing the board, you know, and erasing the stakes that it's building up, which is, like, in a way I kind of respect, and in another way it makes it so hard to pin down, like, a character for these people. Like, if Booker is absorbing all of Comstock's memories from that thing, you know, who knows where he's at when we run into him, you know, like, what even is Booker at any of these points?
I think that's a problem when you throw infinite realities onto the board for any story. Is like, in a way, it almost sucks the meaning out of everything, because literally anything that is weird about the game or anything that you're supposed to interpret, you can just say, well, there's another universe where it's a different way, or it could have been a different way. And it just, it almost, you know, you can't hold anything to anything, or you can't hold anyone to anything. And I that was something I got frustrated with, especially in the DLC, was, like, you know, introducing this concept kind of devoid or voids any of the successes or failures of the characters.
Yeah. It's like it was all a dream.
The only constant that you have is that you, as player Booker, right, are maintaining some level of continuity throughout this, but everybody else is switching around you, right?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Even though, like, player Booker changes, like, Cole may not change controlling player Booker, mm-hmm. and might make the same changes, but, like, Booker is not a silent protagonist. Like, he's, you know, he's got a character, mm-hmm. and it's really important. Like, they reference it constantly, and then they also change it a lot, mm-hmm. you know, in ways that don't really pay off. Like, where he absorbs those Comstock memories, and it gives him a bloody nose and gives him a headache, but, mm-hmm. like, it doesn't really change the things he says, and it happens again and again, you know?
Yeah.
It's very strange.
I guess the way I read it was that he, you know, that this is the Booker who both turned down the baptism and decided to take on his actions and try and absolve them on his own, and was also drawn in by the Lutesses, and he was fated to be the one who succeeded at this. So in terms of him being the one there, it wasn't so much him absorbing the memories and getting the blade noses, it was him suffering through the reconciliation sickness in terms of the multiple hymns dying around him.
I think that they straight up say that, like, when you go, like, you absorb the, like, the consciousness, like, since the Booker in that dimension is dead. Mm. Like, it could just be a throwaway, like, detail that they, you know, and the frustrating thing about that specifically, I'm not trying to be a forest for the trees person, or trees for the forest person, but, like, mm-hmm. is it doesn't really need to be there. Like, that didn't seem like it added very much. Mm-hmm. You know, him getting the headaches and absorbing Comstock's memory, like, narratively, like, that was an unnecessary detail that just caused a lot of headaches. And
yeah.
And
in those
like, yeah, exactly. I didn't mean to do that, but it's true. And like, yeah. That's like, I mean, I feel like that there's an element of like the story that keeps kind of coming up, you know, yeah, like these little flights. Mm-hmm.
I guess to me, I don't know. I mean, I guess my overall thing is all of these kind of narrative flaws, I kind of assumed were the point, I guess, to a certain degree, in that, like, I guess I saw kind of a lot of the overall message as being, you know, kind of the constants and variables, the idea that, you know, there's the different versions of Booker, but ultimately, you know, certain elements remain constant, and, you know, kind of playing with, you know, some of the ideas of sort of free will versus determinism, and then what that has to say both about personal responsibility and about kind of redemption. And so I, to a significant degree, saw a lot of these ambiguities, and particularly the character ones, as kind of being, I just assume that was intentional, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. I think the best that you can hope for due to the multiple realities with kind of who are you as Booker is, like, you are a Booker who happened to do the things that you do in the game, you know, successfully rescue Elizabeth, and, you know, your life ends when you are drowned by the Elizabeths and, you know, coming back to the baptismal
yeah.
pool.
Yeah.
But you just can't say that is like, oh, that ended all Comstocks and Bookers, or that ended all yeah. Elizabeths for that matter. That yeah. was just one in literally an infinite number of ways this could play out.
They claim that they're trying to kill all the Comstocks by doing that.
Yeah, like that actually is the express thing that happens at the end.
But in another universe, they didn't do that.
Yeah.
Wait. Actually, what I would argue, and can we go into Burial at Sea?
I mean, I'd rather us not right now, because we haven't even talked about the best part of the game.
Yeah. So.
See, no, but my issue is, I would say for this, I would say what I liked about Burial at Sea is in my opinion, it makes everything else make sense.
Oh, it definitely puts a neat bow on things. I don't know if the neatness of that bow is a good thing or not, but it puts a neat bow on it.
I guess my interpretation is, you know, grandfather paradox, you know, should say that Elizabeth should, you know, disappear after the end of Bioshock Infinite, because, you know, Comstock never existed. That was the point. The interpretation I would take is that since she continued to exist, presumably because of her you know, ability to kind of exist outside of all this. What ultimately happened at the end of Bioshock Infinite, and this is, you know, from reading various interpretations I've seen, is that ultimately Booker, Anna, Elizabeth, and Comstock's timelines all exist, all collapse to where there was now only one version of each of them. And so Burial at Sea was basically Elizabeth attempting to clean up that one remaining timeline.
Hmm.
So my interpretation would be that initially there were an infinite number of timelines, but after Infinite, there was only one, and that's why things were a little different in Burial at Sea.
Maybe. What I will say is, and maybe this can take us into the actual part of the episode,
please,
is it's
you need to find some place for Cole to cut in. God only knows.
It's a real kind of looper. Whereas if you think about it too much, you know, your head hurts and nothing makes sense. But I found it very effective in driving me through the moment to moment gameplay. Like, yep. I was always interested in what came next, yep. even if that didn't add up to a whole that made sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's along for the ride, and does along for the ride count for anything?
Yeah, and I think that it ultimately does, even though, like, I think that when you first, you know, when this was first scheduled, like I said, like, mm-hmm. like I definitely want to talk about this game. It's aged like milk mm-hmm. for me, because I remember exchanging texts with Cole, like, you know, when I was playing it, just like, this is the real deal. Like, this is great. And I was very engaged in the moment to moment. But I think that there is, you know, it does count for something, but also, like, your memories count for something as well. Like, the way that you can reflect on art.
Yeah.
I love Dumb and Dumber when I was a kid. Yeah. That doesn't mean anything.
Oh, I mean, you haven't pre-ordered tickets of Dumb and Dumber 2?
Dumber or Dumber?
No. There is a literal Dumb and Dumber 2 coming out.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Yeah. It looks terrible.
I don't care.
Is why you're a good man.
Yeah. It's okay to reflect on art and have it change, you know. So, like, in the moment, like, I'm totally with you. And there are so many little moments in this game that I think are brilliant.
Oh, God, yeah.
Like, it's so good at that thing. But the macro, the thing that's going to make it stand up for me, especially, like, as an avowed fan of the series, like, the two things it doesn't have are the play problems that I have, and then this larger story stuff that just feels like, there's a quote I always come back to that's a Brian Eno quote that's like, the difference between hitting a target with an arrow or firing an arrow and drawing a target around where you hit. And like, this feels like firing an arrow and drawing a target around where you hit, you know, which is not a good thing to be, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely kind of a textbook example of fast and loose.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, I don't even know.
Let's talk about that moment to moment.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The first 45 minutes of this game are masterful.
Yeah.
Holy
shit. It's
got
one of the strongest intros of, like a game in recent memory.
And we always talk about how games lead with their worst foot in a lot of instances, right? And, you know, like, all of that bullshit we just said was only with everything in mind. But, like, you know, it's just baffling when you walk into it. And it's like, ooh, creepy. But you get into Rapture. Sorry, I'm going to say Rapture, because Rapture has the religious connotation. But you get
Raptor.
Into Columbia. Yeah, so Raptors have religious connotation. No, but you get into Columbia, and you take this baptism. And I was, like, uncomfortable about accepting it.
Yeah.
But these shrines, and just kind of like everything setting up, and, you know, I don't know if it was just the weight of knowing everything that was going to come ahead, having played it before, but, you know, just all of the foreshadowing that happens here, you know, there's the weight of a potential future around everything that happens, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, yeah, for sure. I don't know, I love the architecture of the kind of church you start out in.
Yeah.
You know, the water work, although I have to say I'm pretty certain that waterfall staircases are not OSHA approved.
I'm glad someone else noticed that, yeah. Most dangerous staircase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most dangerous staircase 2013. Yeah. I almost said staircase.
Ooh. Those are those stairs that collapse and you turn into a slide.
Yeah. Let's do it again. Yeah.
But even I also you know, the part where, you know, it finally opens up and, you know, you see you're kind of doing the walk up to the baptism and all, you know, there's all the other people. Just really good sense of scale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the music, like, you know, just the idea of this hymn, the, you know, let the circle be unbroken, coming through. Like, that is a portent no matter what. No matter where it pops up, that is a portent.
Yeah.
So how do you get from the baptism to where you start then kind of walking? Like, they baptize you, knock you out, and then just like, hey.
No, you drown. It is a very aggressive baptism.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just wake up in another fountain.
Is that, so like... Yeah, I'm just that.
It's like Zelda 3.
That was, you know, maybe an initial moment early in the game of like, what? Like, and I thought they would explain it, and they just never really come back around to it.
Yeah.
Well, I felt like the comeback around to it was ultimately that was a foreshadowing of how it ends.
Yep. Ooh, I wonder if you could put together a theory where Comstock knew who you were when he baptized you the first time, drowned you intentionally to stop you, and then.
That wasn't Comstock who baptized you. That is a blind.
Although it is the same guy both times.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. It is a blind and aged version of the priest who baptizes Comstock in I think it's like 1890 or something like that. Mm. It is 25 or so years before everything happens.
Huh.
Yeah. So it is like roughly like that initial baptism takes place 2 years after the Battle of Wounded Knee, something like that.
Battle of Wounded Knee was 1890, so that would be 1892.
Yeah, and Anna/Elizabeth was born in 1893, because she is 20 in the events in 1812. Or 1813, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, so this is a 20-years-old version of that guy who initially baptized you.
Yeah. Moving on from the baptism, because, you know, we're talking about this 45 minutes, we could talk a little bit about Columbia, like, and just kind of walking through it.
Oh,
and what
sure.
I still think is, like, the strongest part of the game
is this
introduction.
Uh-huh. Did you guys pay when you went into the store?
Yes.
Nope.
Yeah, no.
I did.
For what?
There's a store that has the honor system. Like, they have the Dante Bowl set out.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I probably took that money.
Yeah. I rated the kitty, guys.
Yeah, you Roomba everything because you're in Bioshock mode where you just constantly clicking E on
follow the right wall. Yeah.
Later on, once you get down to the kind of the slum district, I did find it sort of a little cognitive dissonance where, you know, people would be talking about how, oh, I'm dying of whatever disease I have. It's like, well, guess you don't need this food in your bag.
Yeah, you're doomed. Fuck you.
It's cognitive dissonance is such a funny thing because it's kind of a punchline, but it also is a real thing that's worth thinking about. You know, like, yes, it is overplayed, but it's actually a thing. You know, like, it is a buzzword that actually has meaning. You know, it's not a meaningless term.
It is not a thought-terminating cliche. It actually happens.
Yeah, it happens like crazy in this game. So, like, you can't I'm not saying anyone here is doing this, but you can't dismiss criticism of this game by saying, like, making a jerk-off motion and saying, oh, cognitive dissonance, huh? It's like, no, there's tons of cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of weird... Like the when you're talking about the slums, man, the guys who are selling the upgrade thing, where you have to murder them to get it?
Yeah.
Why? I've been collecting money this whole game.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
As a side note, you don't, strictly speaking, have to murder them.
Have to try to murder you.
Yeah.
Now,
like, they will try to shoot you, right?
Or you can just... Granted, I looked online to make sure I can do this, so I cheated, but if you simply leave it alone until the rebellion happens, they'll just be gone.
Okay. It's an alternate version.
The real question is, like, why did no one think, like, hey, I'm going off to war? Nah, I don't need a shield.
Yeah, I don't need this magic juice.
Yeah, like, this thing makes me more effective in general.
Yeah, why can't I buy it? You know, it's so
yeah,
weird.
That's
and, like, these are the good guys. These are the only morally innocent people in the whole game.
Yeah.
They're, like, the, you know, the poor people in the slums.
For sure.
You know?
I really liked the mugging. That part I felt like was well done in terms of, in terms of realism in that, like, yeah, that's probably what would happen if you just randomly walked through some place that where people was this, you know, were, you know, starving to death and where guns are all over the freaking place.
Can you allude to what the mugging is? Because I don't think I ran into that or made a note of it.
That same point where you can either steal it if you walk directly to the bar that's directly in front of you. Before you get there, two guys will try to hold you up,
huh.
And will basically again a similar thing. They demand money, and it kind of annoyed me that you can't just be like, all right, literally am carrying like $2,000, have some money.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. still, yeah, so they basically demand money, and then either if you don't do anything or if you walk towards them or walk away or whatever, you know, they draw and try to kill you.
Yeah. But here we're seeing the exact opposite, and, you know, the World's Fair thing is in full effect here. Like, you are seeing a celebration of what Columbia has achieved, and, you know, all of it's stuff that's going to be foreshadowed. You know, the mechanical the mechanical patriots, all of the vigors and such, set up as carnival games.
Can we just real quick talk about just because it just came up and because it's essential to the thing? Can we talk just a little bit about like what place vigors have in this world?
Oh, for sure.
Like how weird it is that someone is giving out a mind control potion for free to anyone who will take it.
Yeah.
Like how gross and rapey and like just violation
it makes no sense.
And it makes no fucking sense. Mm-hmm. And like
that.
They make sense in Rapture.
Yeah.
Like, Rapture should have them. Uh-huh. Columbia shouldn't. You know, and it just...
That's one I struck, at least personally, I kind of swept under the rug as being just a game convention.
I'm counting three rug sweeps. Just throwing, just keeping a tally of all the hand waves and rug sweeps that are going on. Because it's not... My point is never that, like, you can't hand sweep or rug sweep or do any kind of sweeping. Like I sweep. It's just that you have to do it so often in this game.
And this is something that like the narrative forces you through. It is a gate that you have to pass that gives you what it's frankly, it's a very useful vigor, but
it's probably my favorite vigor of the year 2014.
Yeah, for sure. I mean like, mind control and make them commit suicide every day. But
see, I never used it.
That's funny.
Well, you had to have used it once.
Yeah, you have to use it.
I used it on machine. The only time I actually used it, unless they forced me, I don't remember, is to steal from vending machines, which I used on every vending machine.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the only way that they force you. You're never forced to use it on a person.
Right.
I mean, it's especially weird, like, coming hot on the tails of seeing, like, the bits and pieces of this bourgeoisie, Columbia culture. Right, like everybody just, you know, like, oh, well, you know, let us attend the fete, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's a fete worse than death, right? But but what's happening here is, you know, you're seeing it, and just, it is so incongruous that it just kind of pops up, you know, especially after hearing God Only Knows.
Yeah.
Which I had to force into here, but.
Yeah. If you didn't want to use it as the intro music for the episode, because it is beautiful.
Yeah. So one of my favorite insights that I've heard about this game in general, and I hate to keep constantly name dropping these guys, but it's such a good show. But Video Games Hot Dog, one of them on there said, like, God Only Knows and the Beach Boys are proof, you know, in the context of this narrative, that there are just certain sounds and sequences of pitches that the universe just wants to exist. And just the fact that it pops up here, and with that thing that makes sense later, like, oh, these are songs from the future. This is, you know, the B sharps, right?
Right.
You know, and this is Albert Fink and et cetera. Like, just the idea that, you know, like, this primes you to keep an ear open. Like, it's a stimulator, like, you know, to watch for these covers that are going to pop up. And, you know, God help us all, I'm going to point them out when they pop up.
It's probably my favorite detail in the game, like,
for sure.
Stealing music from the future.
Mm-hmm.
I also liked it as foreshadowing, I guess, or paralleling in terms of, you know, the God Only Knows, you know, how I'd be without you, in terms where a lot of the game is how the presence or absence of a given character can completely change the way someone is.
Yeah, and that's something they do masterfully. Like, all of them are poetically appropriate. Mm-hmm. You know?
All right, so Justify Girls just want to have fun.
Hey, you know, we're just out there on the beach just having a good time.
During that scene, one would argue that she just wants to have fun.
Exactly.
So
she's a girl.
Yeah.
It's also obvious. Yeah.
Elizabeth has the fastest turnaround from, like, and Adrian talked about this a little bit, and I think it's probably a remnant of her being originally written this way, but like, she has the fastest turnaround from like, oh gosh, the world is so new and wonderful, to like, let's get this done.
See, I guess I read this less as character change and more as we're watching PTSD on steroids.
I mean, that makes sense. Like, should, yeah. Like, and, you know, barely, let's see, it bears this out, but just in general, like, everybody loses their innocence throughout this. And, you know, to what degree is that, you know, intentional and manufactured to make somebody steal to do what, you know, the Lutesses ultimately need them to do, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And it's also, is it clear on in Burial at Sea, she's aged, right? It's taken place.
Okay, I mean, it's mostly to make her sexy, but
yeah, I was gonna say, like, that seemed fairly obvious, but because other than that, it, in the storyline, it at least appears plausible that Burial at Sea takes place directly after Infamous. Wow, this is gonna be a thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I think we're getting a little bit sensitive about what happens in that, so I'm going to encourage us to back away from that a little bit and talk about the raffle.
Yeah, we will talk about Burial at Sea later.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But boy, the raffle. Does any human alive? There should be an achievement on Xbox Live or whatever that marks when you choose to throw the baseball at their interracial couple.
Yeah,
The first time you play, definitely.
I tried it the second time just to see if it would let me do it.
Yeah.
Does the same thing happen?
Same thing happens.
Yeah, somebody catches your hand. So
how crazy? Why is he? Why did he pick number 77? And why does he not?
Yeah, does nothing about it.
Why is he such an idiot?
And this is after he saw the big poster with his hand.
Yeah,
on,
there's
right?
a poster that's like, you fucking maniac. What is wrong with you? Don't choose 77. Oh, good to know.
I mean,
good advice.
You know, the mind creates memories where there are none. He doesn't remember having that scar that he left on himself. Like, seriously, I am being the devil's advocate for the crazy bullshit story. So.
Yeah, we'll sweep it under the rug.
I still maintain that the story makes complete sense.
Just a roiling and waving rug that is like the surface of the Indian Ocean.
Like the rug in The Simpsons where they sweep everything under it.
Yep.
Like
yeah. But, you know, constants and variables, right? There's always number 77. And,
there's always going to be a Simpsons reference.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the Duck Feet principle.
Yeah. That's another Duck Feet standard.
I wrote two articles at work today that had Simpsons YouTube links embedded directly.
Nice.
God.
So I'm very curious because I missed this completely the first time around. Well, the first thing I missed is that the Lutesses were like the same people who were rowing me.
Yeah.
And that there was anything. So that coin flip thing was very confusing to me until about like a second from the end. I was like, oh my God, okay.
Yeah.
The second thing that was super confusing is I, for the life of me, cannot tell you how you get from everyone chasing you to the Order of the Crow. I did not understand how the Order of the Crow fit into this game world in any of the universes, how I got there, why they were mad at me, how they related to anyone else. Like, this was really, really surreal for me. Did everyone else get it and I'm just weird, or?
I mean, it's just a place you're routed through, and the Order of the Crow is the clan and a city full of clansmen.
Yeah, the super clan. They're the KKKK.
The Ku Klux Klan.
KKK is for crow.
Go ahead, Ben.
Like, in terms of relevance, I would say the Order of the Crow was interesting to me just by seeing some of like how they viewed America in general. In terms of like, that seemed to be kind of the big breaking point between like Columbia as like ultra America as a cult versus you know, Columbia as succeeding whatever from America.
Yeah, well, I mean, holding up, you know, Booth as opposed to Lincoln, like there's explicit mention to Lincoln was a traitor, whereas Booth was the hero.
And yet Lincoln is one of the automatons later on.
In a later version, that is, that is the Vox having remodeled the automatons.
It's so much of this iconography like falls away just because of that kind of stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen somebody say that before too online. I'm just like, nope, that's not actually everything that happened after that point. Just forget everything that happened before it, because it's not the same world.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
But it makes sense for the Vox to revere Lincoln.
Oh, for sure. But like, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. like the implied dissonance that Dennis expressed there was.
Yeah, I thought I had stumbled into, and again, this is how I read it the first time playing through. I thought I had stumbled into like a government sanctioned anti-government place where they were venerating Booth, not because of all the racial stuff, which hadn't, I guess, came to the fore with the interracial couple, but hadn't really set in for me as anything that was, you know, a huge theme. But, you know, they were venerating Booth because they were like anti-America in general.
Mm-hmm. See, I guess.
And again, that's probably a miss on my part.
The other way I was suspecting part of it was whether it was also, you know, venerating Booth because of Lincoln, some of his, like civil rights violations. But I think that was similarly, that was something where I wasn't, it wasn't clear until, to me, till later on. It's like, no, it's pretty much the racism.
Yeah. Ben, so, I'm going to cut you open a swath here for you to talk.
Oh, sorry.
So, a couple of points. They're called the Order of the Raven, not the Order of the Crows. Mm-hmm. Their motto is, we dare defend our father.
Yeah.
But it's in Latin, and it's very close to Alabama's motto, which is, we dare defend our rights, but mm-hmm. which is also in Latin. Yeah. And their symbols are a crow or a raven, a sword, and a coffin,
yeah.
as opposed to Columbia's sword, scroll, and key. Mm-hmm.
So I'm still not clear. Are they anti-Columbia or for Columbia?
No, they're for Columbia.
For Columbia.
Like they, okay. they hold themselves responsible for the assassination, quote unquote, of Lady Comstock.
They hold themselves responsible as in they did it, or they were wrong for not preventing it?
They were wrong for not preventing it, even okay. though it was Comstock's own doing.
So, fun fact, I played this entire game thinking, like, why are these guys who killed Lady Comstock showing up and helping the guys who are defending Lady Comstock?
Right.
Like, I completely misread
yeah.
that.
No, they are totally Comstock loyalists, just in a really fucked up and weird way.
Yeah, they're okay. extremists.
Yeah.
yeah, fucked yeah. up and weird is a great way to describe
yeah.
the entirety of this game.
Yeah, or in yeah. general, like, you know, Gary, I thank you for saying the E word, because you can describe all of Ken Levine's philosophy as extremism is bad.
Yeah, well, we don't even need to get, like, I figured later we talk about, you know, the kind of, like, pussy centrism of this game that is like, oh, the revolutionaries are bad, too. Everyone's just as bad. There's nothing... Yeah. You know, we can't take a stand at all, like on anything.
Yeah,
like
Park.
Racism is bad and murder is bad. If you can agree with those two things, you are the audience for Bioshock Infinite. Like, and then when they try to, again, we'll talk about it in Burial Sea, but when they kind of try to, when they revisit,
yeah, when they back out of that, yeah.
yeah, when sure. they back
are
out,
are we going
that,
to address that later?
Out.
No, yes. no, we're not. Well, I mean, we're, I mean, never. How late? How much later?
Address, I guess that's true.
Addresses or will have addressed.
Yeah.
So I actually saw that as the strength of the overall story, but we can get into that later.
Yeah.
Can I step back to, I'm sorry, the raffle real quick, the decision on whether to Sorry, I didn't realize you were people were moving on from that until we were kind of already on.
No, I'm just wondering what there is to say about it.
I felt was really, really strong about this. You know, it was kind of, I think as we kind of said, probably the most boring more choice of all times in terms of like pretty much everyone took the one side.
Mm-hmm.
What I felt was really strong about this, though, was that it sort of forced you to go from you know, just an observer of everything that was going on to an active participant.
Yeah.
And so I would say the more interesting, more choice would be, you know, would you have stepped in and done something if you mm-hmm. hadn't been forced to be a participant?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, the where this goes, and I feel a little bit ashamed to admit this, but, like, in hindsight, I can recognize, like, oh, everybody that I'm seeing, like, eating, you know, button candy and talking about the fair as white, like as lily white as the driven snow, like that is only something that came to me on the second playthrough or up mm-hmm. until the point that I saw this. But like, this is the point that it's abundantly clear, like, oh, only white people have this kind of privilege here.
Yeah,
and like,
I think
you're forced
a huge
to be a monster
of the game. Yeah,
yeah.
Like the fact that the game has to underline it through that before you realize that there are no minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Up until yeah. that point, because I did the same thing and I felt guilty about it. Like, mm-hmm. oh, why did I not question this?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And part of it is because it's kind of a period piece, but like mm-hmm. the fact that that isn't, you know, it doesn't clang on your eyes, like is, mm-hmm. is noteworthy.
Yeah. I mean, like I've thought about that. Like I feel shitty that I didn't think like, well, wait a minute here.
And you also did a shooting mini game where you're shooting minorities. Oh, minorities. So yes. Hopefully that's where it clicked for me.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I don't remember doing that the first time though. I think that I was just kind of like walking around wide eyed, soaking in the culture as yeah. opposed to actually going in and experiencing it. Man.
It didn't bother me because I played this after Resident Evil 5. I was all good. Win in Rome, buddies.
I guess for me, it's kind of I knew what the game was about going into it, so you know it was kind of obvious. So I know I'm kind of disappointed that I didn't go into it more more just blind.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's hard to keep yourself from soaking some of that stuff in ahead of time, though.
Right. Like, well, especially because I mean that moral choice was the one that was in like. Every preview or review or anything that talked about this.
Yeah.
And early in the game, too. So
it's super early in the game, and also it's like a crazy red herring, and like in the truest sense of the word, which is like they really want you to think that this is what, you know, that's what this is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not what the game is about, mm-hmm. like in general, you know?
Yeah. It's really not. I found that fine. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else is noteworthy in kind of the early game? Like, I feel like it's good that we are backing away and talking about grander kind of things and kind of taking a step back, but mm-hmm. there probably still are little moments that are worth touching on.
Yeah. Well, I think your first encounter with Elizabeth was a problem for me because you, like, are watching her through all these apparently one-way mirrors in a very creepy way before meeting her for real.
Like, once you get to Monument Island, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if they... Like, if that was intentional, like, hey, we want you to feel awkward about this, or if that was, you know, some misguided marketing guys be like, we need some eye candy, or, you know, I don't know what the intent of that was, but it just felt off.
It's a little bit brushed away by the fact that, you know, like, it's a panopticon, and she had no idea she was being watched.
A panopticon? Like
she was just entirely in isolation.
Oh, is that what that is?
Well, no,
yeah, she freaks out later on when you're running out and mm-hmm. she ultimately stumbles upon one of those. Yeah. She kind of freaks out, and that's sort of the first instance of her, to a certain degree, realizing the degree to which she's a victim.
Yeah, to like the degree to which the existence she's been living has been entirely artificial. Panopticon
but you've been
being
in a
like
library.
It's like a nice house, but like, you know. Mm. Yeah, but she's Panopticon being like a prison where it's designed for you to always be watched at any time, or to always assume that you're being watched.
Gotcha.
Right. Yeah, but she never assumed. So like, it is meant to be creepy and kind of, you know, just like gross outy. And the second that you know, one way mirror goes clear, feeling a little bit gross, I think that you are meant to feel like you were invading somebody. Right.
There's also I'm assuming this was intentional, but a somewhat subtle one in that in the photo lab, one of the photos is of her when she's changing, is naked. I mean, granted, it's not graphic. It's like, you know what I mean? But like, that's, you know, there's some little details.
Or just the grossness as you're like seeing these artifacts of her in a bell jar. Like, you know, there's, her childhood teddy bear. Her first dress and menarche. Like, okay,
are those
super
the things
gross.
You zap?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why did you zap them?
I mean, misunderstanding about what her power is contained in. So all of those are heightened emotional artifacts.
Gotcha. Okay.
The was menarche. I had to look that up, and that was creepy.
it's one of my favorite unsettling words.
Yeah. So I mean, you kind of. You break her out, Songbird comes after you, and this was the first inkling I got that, I am not going to be able to fight this thing. Like, I am powerless against it, which is really cool.
It's so fucking big. Like, it doesn't attack you, it attacks the environment that you're in.
Yeah. And I went into this game assuming that was the Big Daddy equivalent.
Yeah.
Which they have a very clear other Big
Daddy
equivalent.
It was billed at that. Like, I remember reading the Game Informer about it, thinking like, okay, and here's Songbird, and this is the Big Daddy. Okay, cool. And then when it didn't end up being that, I was like, I was a sad coal.
Well, and to be fair, Songbird... Sorry, I'm stepping back from that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's a wonderful visual design.
Oh,
like,
for sure.
Songbird looks really, really cool.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, but like, simultaneously both robust and also just like, this is a frame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Obviously, I'm a big fan of steampunk, but there's actually a surprising little amount of steampunk in this, especially compared to, like, say, like, Rapture, where, like, everything is crazy, you know, cobbled together from gears and engines. And I felt like Songbird was a really good steampunk design. A little bit of maybe, and was it Art Nouveau or whatever?
Yeah. And there was more of that in the preview builds of that. Like, the, you know, that this was supposed to be Art Nouveau set in stark contrast to Rapture's Art Deco, right? Like, this was supposed to be much more frilly than it ultimately was. But, like, this is the main holdover, I think, of both versions of that, both play and also visuals, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So you only escape them by, like, falling so far underwater that, but I don't know how you aren't crushed to death if Songbird's eyes.
Yeah,
how do you mean, like, meat? Like, meat is more resilient than, you know, yeah, than glass.
Science. Aqua Booker.
Also, it's weird that nobody notices it falling apart when Booker falls in with other stuff, like other parts of the building falling into Battleship Bay as well.
Yeah.
And, well, similarly, like, no one seems to care very much that Elizabeth is, like, doing CPR on some random guy in the middle of a beach.
Hey, whatever, well, you're into.
Nobody really knows who Elizabeth is. They've heard about the lamb, but there's never been, like, pictures of her put out.
Yeah. Oh, I would be more just, like, I feel
it's,
like...
It's a public emergency.
Yeah.
Yeah, like... Like, this, I can understand that in Rapture, but this seems like a reasonably conscientious society.
Except for black people.
Well, yeah.
I will say, the escape from Elizabeth's cage was really nice, though. Like, going on the skyline and having it fall apart and then landing in Battleship Bay. Oh, no, when the music picks up, it's very good.
Yeah. Very effective. And at a certain point here, the skyhooks were introduced. Like, you pick up the you know, crazy gauntlet from one of the policemen.
The murder one.
Yeah. The murder hook.
Yeah, the murder hook. The non-utility murder hook, essentially.
Yes, it strikes me as a little weird. I like that as Booker's weapon because of, you know, the degree to which, you know, a lot of, particularly the early part of the story, is him kind of on the run, you know, kind of just grabbing whatever is at hand and trying to fight his way out in a path of destruction. So I really like the skyhook from that. I feel like, in particular, the first, you know, fighting your way out of the raffle was really good use of its over-the-top goriness. On the other hand, it seems a little bit weird that, like, your average police officer is equipped with that.
I mean, I think that, like, that is fully intentional because it's like, oh, look, the average police officer is meant to inflict this kind of brutality that you are also inflicting on people. This is fucked up, making people's necks go rectal.
Yeah, it's a tool. Like, it wasn't that the police officer was supposed to be smashing people's faces with it. They were supposed to be getting around with it.
Hmm.
Like, you're repurposing it.
I feel like I heard dialogue about, like, yeah, we're going to be able to bust some real heads with this. But
yeah, they do. Mm. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I opted not to do executions because it really, really bothered me to see people's necks bend that way.
See, yeah, it was so over the top for me that it just lost all meaning. And I think, I can't remember who I had this conversation with, but it's like, you know, they wanted it to be shocking and they did it and it was a little, you know, they were like, you know, let's try to up the ante here, and they made it more shocking, and then people were just desensitized to it faster, so they tried to make it more shocking so people were desensitized to it faster, and it's just so over the top that it loses any kind of reality to it.
It's not the only thing that's shocking. Like, when you possess people and they murder themselves afterwards, that's pretty shocking as
that
well.
That was much more effective.
Yeah, pretty gross.
See, I guess I felt like it was effective, like I said, you know, early on, where it was very much like you, you know, just kind of busting your way out, you know, trying to do that. And I felt like it was effective in Elizabeth's reactions to it. I felt like it lost its effectiveness once those two points were met, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'd assume is that they put it in intending to kind of accomplish those goals, and then it ended up, you know, now it's in and it doesn't make as much sense for the rest of the game.
Hmm. Yeah.
But, although part of this could be that, you know, I like, you know, some of the, you know, Ong Bak, Steven Seagal, you know, Breaking Elbows and Next type action movies. So I do think there's a certain degree to which it bothered me a little bit less simply because that's a genre I'm more used to. So,
honest question. Does the rest of, like, the metaphysical stuff and things that happen in this game feel like it belongs to that same genre?
I have mixed feelings. Like, I feel like there's a certain degree to which it's, you know, the metaphysics and stuff like that, but I feel like it's also a, you know, kind of a sci-fi adventure game. And so I'm a little ambivalent. Like, it didn't strike me as just, like, horribly jarring, although at the same time, I can completely understand why people felt it was out of place. I guess it didn't break immersion for me, but it didn't, other than the at the those couple of points at the beginning, it really didn't build it for me.
I was going to say, like, I don't think anybody who has a problem with the violence has a problem in general with violence in media. Oh, you know, like, yeah, we all play video games. Yeah. Like, we're fine with that. I think it's just the fact that it feels like it belongs in another game.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I can agree with that. I guess...
Yeah, it's not that it was, like, bad. It was just out of place.
No.
Yeah, like, it didn't strike me as being over the top, so, but at the same time, it did kind of seem like... It would have made a lot of sense, I think, in the original BioShock, because the original BioShock was, you know, body horror was a big part of it. Whereas in this one, it felt like it wasn't. And so I'll agree, like, it more to me seemed like I was, because of that, I was expecting the game at some point to get much more into the original BioShock, like, giant needles and, like, you know, your hand, you know, all these weird stuff, and it never really does that. So yeah, I'll agree. Yeah, it does seem a little odd.
Related, and just be, or, I'm sorry, Ben, go ahead.
I was gonna say, at the same time, I don't think I would be able to offer a better suggestion for how they could have done the violence that they did. I think it might be an issue as far as the content, not necessarily the execution, because I mean, a lot of their violence at times was, like, over the top cartoony, like, in the sense that if someone shot their head, their entire head was gone, you know, like, I don't know how they could have done the same thing, but in a better tone, you know?
Yeah. I've seen less disturbing gore in a Soldier of Fortune video game.
Hmm. Like, yeah, they just would have had to make it a little less visceral, you know, like, there's tons of video games that have that level of violence and do it without it feeling like it's the centerpiece.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be more disturbed by, like, was it a Dead Space game than I would this game, because of the sense of, even though it's violence, it is very much stylized violence, where it's, like, it's over the top to the point where, or that kind of makes it less serious for me, at least, when things like that happen, like, where heads will fly off. I don't think it's necessarily the best thing to have in the game, but... Yeah, I guess I've been more disturbed by other forms of violence in video games.
It might just be the starkness of that contrast.
Yeah, I think I want to piggyback. This is not following our notes list, but because you know we don't want to record all night, and because while I have a lot of people here who play this game, I have a question I want to ask everybody. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a grander thematic thing. Yeah. Do you think, with what this game does well and what it does poorly, do you think this game benefits from being a shooter? Or do you think this would have been better as an adventure game? Because I think it would have.
I had more fun playing it on easy than I did on normal on my playthrough. Going ahead.
Go ahead.
What do you mean as, like, an adventure game?
I mean, like, that the
you mean like old school? Well, not necessarily like
combine the garbage hot dog with the fireworks to
yeah.
make
yeah,
the.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that
like
is
The
that
Walking Dead,
mean, like item yeah. puzzles and stuff like that.
No, like The Walking Dead, like a game where like it's about the story and relationships and dialogue, yeah. which are the things I think this game does well. Or, I mean, mm-hmm. the story I have problems with, but I think that's the compelling stuff in the game. And what I felt like they wanted to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I what I would say is I don't think it would work that way. One, because of what you just said, is that the overall story makes no goddamn sense. And that would be just brought infinitely more to the forefront if this was, you know, an adventure game where all you had was the story. And then second, referencing the Clash in the Clouds DLC, which I've spent a bit of time playing, like, I honestly think that the moment-to-moment combat and shooting and everything is a lot of fun. And yeah. again, even though there are these tonal differences that we just spent a lot of time talking about, I enjoyed, you know, the shooting mechanics of the game and the combat of the game. So I you know... Again, that can be totally independent of any story, but I'm glad it was in BioShock Infinite because it was good.
I feel like, I'm kind of positing. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm like kind of positing the question as somebody who had an opposite reaction
yeah.
to that. Like, I feel like the gamey parts of this are more or less inexcusable. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like they're really bad. But
see, I guess I'd say both in terms of like the story as a whole. I'm thinking. Specifically saying story, not plot, I feel like the story was an excellent action-adventure game. You know, it was exciting. It you know, was compelling. So to me, I feel like the overall experience, the overall story was really, really good. And so I wouldn't necessarily want to see it change to something that was not action-y. I could see it be something like, I'm not saying like literally this, but like something like a Hitman or Assassin's Creed or Fallout 3, where it was a little bit more emphasizing more some of the intrigue elements as opposed to the straight combat elements. But I feel like, I don't know. I really like the action. I'd say on the gameplay mechanics, I actually loved the gunplay in this. I thought the gunplay in this was some of the best of any game I've ever played.
Hmm. Cole was going to say something, and I feel like I cut him off.
Yeah. I mean, I'll throw this in here. I feel like if they would have hewn closer to BioShock 1, just in terms of what kept that interesting with the Big Daddy fights, and in terms of like making each environment feel like it was part of a whole, or, you know, making it feel like it was, you know, it really interlinked with the encounter. They were feigning towards that with like every plasmid, or sorry, Vigor has a trap version, but they kind of dropped that and made it more towards, you know, shoot man's kind of thing. And I feel like if they made it, you know, kind of like a straight up adventure game kind of thing, they really could have made the violence mean something. In terms of, like, you know, the most emotionally devastating moments in The Walking Dead, you know, if it was just like, okay, mouse over blank's head and shoot him to spare his dad, okay, yeah, that would have sucked as an action thing, but as a binary choice, that, you know, that really made sense. See, like, you could sell the drama of that if it wasn't made prosaic by the notion of turning it into this thing that everybody has experience with, which is a, you know, first person shooter. You know, mm-hmm. I don't feel that the shooting is, you know, especially offensive. I feel it's kind of bland, and you know, just I can't see the skyhook part of this without seeing like, oh, let's turn this into an on rails experience or into Sonic Adventure 2. So like, you know, so like the arena based combat, you know, just turns me off. For that particular reason, that's why I immediately jumped to easy, so I can get to the part of it that I find more interesting. But like taking it down to, you know, something where they have more control over how grand and how personal the story gets would have only benefited everything, as opposed sure. to putting in a little bit of what feels like filler to my sensibilities as a dyed in the wool Dear Esther gone homie-ite, you know.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
Good.
And what I'd say, like, my overall feeling is I completely understand why people feel that way, and I think I very much see like how you could have a standalone game that was just the metaphysical stuff. It's just a game I would probably never play, and because that's not something that interests me. And I would say, for me, I'm, you know, probably like first-person shooter action adventure is my preferred genre. So I prefer it to be in that genre, but I think that's just something that for me is strictly because of my personal preference.
Oh, sorry. I didn't drop my foot off my toy piano in response to that comment. It was just an accident. I don't want to posit myself as being like, I do like Dear Esther and Gone Home and things like that, but I do like an action game. Like, I like games that have shooting and stuff. Like, it's not like, I'm not against that genre by any means. I just didn't like, you know, how this game did it. And if I did, I might have a different, I might like those two things next to each other.
It hurts to see missed opportunities. I'm sorry to interrupt, but like that I think is the pain that I feel most when I see this.
Yeah.
See, do you feel that the shooting's any worse than the first game?
I don't feel like the shooting is worse. I feel like the systems in place are much worse. I feel like Big Daddies are 1,000 times more interesting than Handyman.
Agreed.
I think that the traps, like there's more traps, more security, more like just things for you to play with than there are in this one. And the vigors, the tonics have more utility to them because you're manipulating those systems. Whereas, I felt like the tonics or the vigors or what have you, and I think that's even more true in Bioshock 2, which I think is really underrated. But the vigors in this very much felt samey. Like, it didn't feel like there was that much difference in using Bucking Bronco versus using Murder of Crows versus tossing fireballs, like whatever you needed to do to do a big crowd control thing. And I just found one that I put upgrade points into and just slam jammed it to kind of get through the combat. And I didn't play through on easy. I should have. I wish I had, because it made some of the bosses really a slog. But the setting up for a Big Daddy encounter is amazing. It's one of my favorite video game things that has ever happened to me in a game. Like, that's so fun. You have to plan for it. There's a sense of anticipation and relief and all these things. And these guys feel just bosses. And same thing with the mechanized patriots. Like, they just feel like, yep, these things are going to shoot at you, and they come out.
But at least the mechanized patriots, I understood how those works. The handymen just were inscrutable to me. So not only was it no fun to fight them, I had no idea of what rules they followed, or they could chase me around the zip lines, or they could electrify them, or they were just constantly right on top of me.
Yeah.
And I never really understood what I was supposed to do to prevent that.
I think it's the problem with the zip lines. I don't understand what they do. I mean, get that they're part of the, we're in the sky and it's a magical society. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But
from a gameplay perspective, what do they add?
It locks me into moving very quickly in one direction without really being able to see anything.
Yeah, not to reference this again, but in the Clash in the Clouds DLC, where it's purely just combat arenas where you are, overwhelmed with enemies, they become, they really shine. Okay, I get this.
Yeah.
See, I would say, at least to me, zip lines were basically the Bioshock Infinite equivalents of the gargoyles from Arkham Asylum. So for me, it was basically when crowd control gets crazy, go up to a zip line, zoom around, quickly hop down when you're on better terms.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I feel like, or I'm sorry to, like, just the different, I love Arkham City, but the difference to me is that people are never going to not know you're there in this game.
Oh yeah.
They're always going to train hit scan weapons on you no matter what you're doing. So you're just going to constantly take damage. Mm-hmm. Kind of no matter what you do, you can kind of reposition yourself, but everyone is instantly aware of where you're at. Instantly is always going to be firing, non-projectile weapons at you that you have no chance of, you're just going to kind of take chip damage continuously.
Sure. And I guess I don't know. I did not find personally that they tracked me particularly well when they're on the zip line. But what I tended to do is get on the zip line and then a second or two later get off. So it was just strictly put some distance between me and the Patriot or me and the handyman.
Yeah, it's around this point that you start getting access to Elizabeth's terror abilities, which is that is a big part of the zip lines, which is putting you closer to something that is advantageous to activate, whether that is medkits or ammo or something else that will fight for you in your stead. Right.
And I, I guess, yes. I guess I should step back and say I agree. I feel like the zip lines never really made sense to me. I did use them some. But yeah, I never really got into, especially since so much of the clothing was related to them.
Yeah. So, I mean, and the clothing customization is more just like, okay, how do you play? Do you want to say yes or no to this thing that may or may not complement how you play?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stepping back to the shooting in general, I think for me, in the original Bioshock, I virtually never used plasmids. To the degree I did early on, I used the electric shock a little bit, and I never wanted to. And if they weren't in the game at all, that would not, I would lose no sleep. In this game, I used exclusively Devil's Kiss as basically a stand-in to grenades. So I will say probably my view of the shooting system is significantly skewed by the fact that I didn't ever want plasmids or vigors to be in the game. But I will say, to me, the big strength of the shooting system was that all of this, I felt like all of the weapons were very easy to do whatever that weapon is supposed to do. So, for example, normally, like a sniper rifle, my experience with that is like, pick it up, take a minute to get my sights on target, and then miss half my shots. Whereas in this, you could pretty much just pick up a sniper rifle and use it as a sniper rifle. And so I guess I would almost compare it to, I felt like the action in this game was just enough action to have you be an action hero so that it could be a cool action story. And not enough to actually, you know, me worry about, dying that often. Does that make sense?
Maybe insofar as if it wasn't a carbine, I wasn't interested.
See, I never really used the carbine. That's interesting.
Yeah, see, I used every weapon.
You had to.
Yeah.
Like, they give you a limit of two, so you don't really get to choose how you want to play. You have to use what you have ammo for.
Yeah.
See, I never really ran out of ammo.
Yeah, because Elizabeth keeps throwing you ammo.
Yeah.
Like, and see, full reloads.
She pulls it from other multiverses, implicitly killing other bookers.
Yeah. Who don't have ammo. Yeah. I played through on hard because it was Sean Elliott, who is one of, probably my favorite games journalist, who worked on the development of this game, recommended it. He said, like, that's how you're going to get the most out of it. And I ran out of ammo constantly.
See,
so that's a little bit my own fault, but it is... It's not balanced for that.
I was swimming. That's definitely a factor of being on hard mode then, because
yeah.
I was swimming in ammo.
I played on normal. And actually, I guess I liked the two-weapon system because my feeling on it was I felt like that, to a certain degree, enabled them to slightly overpower each of the weapons because you would only have two of them at once. So, for example, the shotgun had a much longer effective range in this than would be normal in a first-person shooter. Similarly, like the sniper rifle and the carbine could both be used fairly effectively at close range. So I felt like by limiting you, that gave them freedom to kind of expand on, kind of unbalance some things, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I kind of fail to see how that's an advantage, though, like, as opposed to making it, making them balanced as weapons and then giving you the choice to play how you'd like. I just didn't have if you want to be able to use a situational weapon and you want to keep kind of this toolbox around, which is how FPSs have always done it, mm-hmm. I just don't see what you're really gaining from it. Like, yes, they are a little bit more powerful because you only had two of them, but... Like, that didn't feel like a good trade-off to me. Like, I would have rather had a... me and Cole talk about it all the time and watch out for fireballs. Like, it is all about the verb. Like, I want to be able to do as many things in a game as I can. And, like, I'm never going to look kindly on, things being taken away from me to do.
I guess, I guess for me, and again, this could be, specifics of my idiosyncrasies with playing. In most games, because of that, I end up... because, again, the weapons are so situational, my verb is always assault rifle. Because it's, you know, the thing that can apply to anything. Whereas in this game, because things were less situational, I felt much more freed up in order to, you know, vary my play style.
Yeah. I think maybe what they went for is, like, it, you know, you probably play games where you would naturally try all the weapons, versus I think a lot of players, myself included, will kind of find something that works and then be too scared to deviate from it because I you know,
yeah.
This is my rifle, this is my gun, I know how it works.
Yeah.
And so this forced me to actually play around and improvise with different weapons, you know, where in a way that I certainly would not have.
Or yeah, kind of a similar thing. Like in the original BioShock, I never used the grenade launcher because the ammo was very limited, and there was never a situation that was situational enough that was like,
yeah,
you know, that was like, obviously now is the time for the grenade launcher.
Yeah.
So it never got used.
And you're gonna find a bunch of the situations in here. Like they're like, who the fuck ever uses a heater in this game? Like,
yeah, like, I never used any of the Vox weapons.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the Vox weapons sucked.
Yeah.
I will say that. For some reason the Vox weapons were pretty much all awful.
There's a room where the light won't find you. Holding hands while the walls come tumbling down. They do, I'll be right behind you.
So you guys, I'm going to be the bad guy and say that it is 11:30 at night, and we've only gotten through 2.5 chapters of this goddamn game.
I was going to say, maybe what we need to do is, you know, spend more time on the generalities, which is where all the discussion is anyway, and treat the plot as one of the generalities.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's stop forcing ourselves. Yeah. I'm not saying you're doing this, but let's never force ourselves back into the notes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I just want to make sure that, like, we're not going to hold ourselves to that because we're going to be here for goddamn ever.
So let me put it this way. You're trying to get to an airship. You get forced into Plot Dump Museum, where they kind of catch you up on the history.
You find Slate, and like you see the exact extent to which this revisionist history like led us, you know, just straight up glorify two of the most like horrible and racist, you know, massacres that have existed in this entire, you know, United States history.
It's cartoonish.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. It's very cartoonish. And Slate's character of "I want my men to die with honor" is especially cartoonish. Like,
yeah,
it's
soldiers,
cartoonish,
right?
In a way that was not intentional.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a caricature. So I mean, you get the plot dump, you get the MacGuffin,
and that's borne out by like later on when you find out like that alternate Booker was, you know, sided with him and like burned down the Hall of Heroes.
Right.
Like
yeah.
here's my war buddy. Let's make this happen. Blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you kind of get to the airship that you've been trying to get to. Elizabeth gets wise to you. And it starts this really weird whiplash in between she hates you and realizes you're no good versus she still wants to keep you around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I felt like in many places, like she would constantly be like, you're no good, and then, you know, dump you. And you only came back because that's, you know, she needed the game to advance. Like, you know, there was no good reason for her to keep you around.
Yeah. Well, she knew that you were the only way out.
Yeah.
It also
Except
seemed
like
it seemed like she had trouble protecting herself as well when you were not around, because mm-hmm. she was being trapped by those dudes in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is fair. Like, when she's running away from you, she gets freaking superpowers and can, like, you know, stymie you all she wants. And then yeah. two guards show up and she's helpless.
I love the tears that she opens. Like, oh, balloons, no!
Yeah.
Can I ask a pointed question? Not that I try to turn every good thing about this game into a criticism of it. Don't you wish you could do things like that in battle?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, why are there only four things that she can summon? It's so dumb.
Yeah.
Like, putting up balloons or a train or something, that's uh-huh. badass. Like,
yeah.
that would have been incredible.
Uh-huh.
I think the weirdest summon is the very first area where you learned open tears. She can open up a discount vendor,
mm-hmm.
except that
mm-hmm.
has no inventory, and that never appears at any point later on in the game. I'm really, like, legitimately, I'm... I'm really confused by that.
They went out of business in the alternate dimension.
Yeah. Hard times, hard times.
Did you guys use the tears a lot?
I mean,
because you could have one open, and it made no sense not to have any open.
I always just found the turret, and that was like it.
Yeah. Playing through on hard, you have to use them a lot. Yeah. Like I had to do cover a lot of the time.
Yeah.
I used the weapons a fair amount, and I used the sometimes I would use the skyhook so that I could get up and get a jump off the skyhook and auto kill someone if there are people I was having trouble and I just needed to make sure that a person was dead.
Yeah. I want to know if there's a playthrough of this game out there where it's entirely just someone hopping on and off of skyhooks to kill everyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a pale substitute, right? Because like in BioShock 1, you're meticulously preparing for these for these Big Daddy fights that, don't happen until you choose when they start, right? Like mm-hmm. like the tears are your ability to influence the geometry of the battlefield. And it just doesn't quite work as well as you would like it to,
It never swayed a battle for me.
Yeah,
it probably should have. Mm-hmm. For how important it is and how thematically key it is to the game. Mm-hmm. Like it should have been better. Mm-hmm. And that's an easy thing to say. I understand like game development's hard, blah de bloop, but like that, I feel like some of the resources and things could have went into that and made it. Made the actual theming integral to the gameplay as opposed to making it antithetical to the gameplay, which is what ended up happening. Like the theming that we're all responding to doesn't work with the ultraviolence, mm-hmm. but we all like this quantum stuff. Why isn't that more key to the actual play as opposed to just the story that's happening around the play?
And like, just make it hard to find something that really, really, influences the flow of the battle. Right,
yeah.
like a golden snitch.
Exactly, it's like you make it so that like as you are running and trying to hide from stuff and trying to manage the fight, like oh, here's this weird little thing over here that totally sways it.
Well, part of why they can't do that is other battle like things that they've like other systems in the mechanics that don't contribute to that, like specifically the health thing, mm-hmm. where like you have no control over your durability, given that like you have to wait for Elizabeth to either toss you something or you have to go root around in the garbage while fighting for health pickups.
It's funny. I know you didn't like the shield in this game. That is exclusively what I upgraded until I couldn't upgrade it anymore.
Yeah, me too.
And that made
specifically because it sucked.
Yeah, but I didn't have that problem of rooting around for health packs because of my shield.
It's probably because I played on hard. I do feel like I should be able to play on hard, but like the shield just like crumbles real quick. And then when I played about half of it in medium, and I still felt like the shield, at least before you upgrade it quite a bit, mm-hmm. Crumbles too fast, like faster than I want, like faster than like shields in other games do. Yeah.
I would say definitely. I didn't find that way early game, but definitely. Late game, particularly like once you finally for the last time rescue Elizabeth and going after Comstock, where they're just like, let's just keep throwing Patriots and stuff like that at you. Then it dropped real quick, and I would say that was kind of weak. Also with the tears, I never quite understood by that point they established that she can now summon tornadoes. Like, that seems like in some reality, Godzilla has to exist.
Well, yeah, and then it
becomes Scribblenauts.
Yes. They established that what she can bring in is very much based on her emotions. So to our question... earlier, about why doesn't she summon in more stuff? What emotions do you think each of the items represent?
Well, I mean, she says it's wish fulfillment. Like, I wish this would like get
she
us through
really
here
likes
better.
Freight hooks.
Yeah. What emotion is a freight hook?
Stoicism.
Yeah.
So many freight hooks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like, it's funny that we're talking about this because this is right about the point in the narrative where the tears become like a thing.
Yeah.
And it starts dissolving all of the fabric.
Yeah. So you like go through, and once you pop, you can't stop. Like it starts happening really, really rapidly. So, you know, Daisy Fitzroy, the Vox Populi leader, kind of sends you to get guns. You open a series of tears to try to get the guns and wind up in a world where, you know, that she's won. Yeah.
Yeah.
And nothing matters. Nothing you've done so far matters.
And yeah, nothing like is as it seems.
Like two reset. Kind of random ones with that. Is one, did it seem to me like, obviously, like by the end, the Vox Populi are now wrecking up the place, but it also seemed like the final version, the founders, had kind of radicalized.
I mean, they were always radicalized. Yeah. Well, like, holy shit, dude.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
When I say radicalized, but what I mean is, like, previous to that, all of the founder enemies you saw were very much, like, old-timey, like, police dudes. Whereas after that, it was, like, everyone was either, like, ultra-military stuff, which makes sense because there's war going on, or, like, all the uniforms were now, like, I bought this from the discount Nazi store.
For sure, yeah. But also, like, all of the mechanized patriots start becoming Comstock.
Oh, yeah. I did not notice that. That's true. The other thing, though, that struck me as a little bit weird is the second tear. Before you go back to get the...
Gun? The second tear is to move the weapon.
No, before
the,
that.
The tools.
The first one is to save the dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The first tear, the guy is apparently married to
to a Chinese lady. Yeah.
No, after that.
Yeah, to an American
white lady.
Like, yeah, so yeah, to white lady, yeah.
So does that mean in that reality, all of a sudden, interracial marriage was okay? Like, that struck me as a little weird. Like, did we skip past the reality where maybe Colombia was slightly less racist?
I mean, you know, it's a different part of that society.
She goes to Paris in the 80s, like earlier. Like, they don't have to go 1 degree at a time when they do terrorists. Like, they're just totally – they can be as far as they need to be.
I'm just saying, like, that struck me as a little bit weird that, like, all of a sudden something that, like, I don't know.
I like the idea of this guy eternally suffering through every reality.
I hate to interrupt I'm sorry.
Oh, I was gonna say, I like that they dangle that possibility though, David, with the first Vox phone that you hear, where Comstock's like, "Is it insane that you know that white people are better than black people?" And you know, like, yeah. And then, but then he finishes it with like, "But is it insane to like not follow religion to oppress these people? That's even more insane." And then it's like a bait and switch. That's a very poor paraphrase, but. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it cruel? Like, it's all around. What is the definition of cruel? Like, and Comstock is very much about asserting he knows better. He knows what's better for these people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to derail. I just know that we have 20 minutes left, and I haven't complained about Ghost Mom fight.
Yeah. So we probably
Ghost
should.
Mom in general. So
like, Ghost Mom, but also like what a missed opportunity Fink was, which we can all agree.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, and Fink 10 is really cool. Yeah. Like, one of my favorite, again, this game excels at small moments. Like, the people bidding how fast they can do a job.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
what a great detail that is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good job, you know?
Yeah. Or the fucking, gospel performance of Fortunate Son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very beautiful.
It ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no millionaire son. It ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no fortunate one.
Like, it's like just like every part of that was just the best. Oh man, sorry. I'm also a CCR fan, as all
Ghost
of us are, I guess.
Out.
Yeah, and then Ghost Mom and shits on everything, like Ghost shits
forever.
That did have one of my favorite lines though from the game, which is just Booker, Elizabeth, why is your mom a ghost?
Yeah. It is so not a good thing when characters criticize the plot.
Yeah,
like what? It is a sign that something has gone wrong.
And also, like, whenever it's like, oh no, my motivations are becoming part of hers. okay, mm-hmm. I guess. Now, like, it's again fast and loose, like stools.
See, I would say plot-wise, it didn't bother me. Although I think we've established, just in general, I'm the only one that liked the plot, so that's weird. But,
well, I mean, I liked Looper. Again, I really enjoyed Looper while I was watching it,
yeah.
And it was like it seemed like everything was coming together in this perfect timey-wimey way. And then I got done with it, and I thought about it, and I was like, oh, it all falls apart.
Well, I mean, it's the ride versus 2 days after the ride.
Yeah.
Whereas I love Looper, and I think Looper does whatever you need to do to make something stand up after not making sense. Looper does better than this.
Yeah.
Sure. I guess I feel like taken as a whole with the DLC, it makes sense, but we'll get to that. But Ghost Mom is mechanically annoying as heck.
Oh my God.
Well, I mean, it's the worst.
The only saving grace about this chapter is the fact that Shiny Happy People plays a ragtime version of Shiny Happy People.
I feel really bad because I didn't pick up on any of these music cues.
That's great. Like, you just hear it. It's like this little melody. It's like, wait a minute. Do I know that? Yes, you do.
Yeah. That's some of the most fun that you can have in the game.
Yeah.
Is doing that. Yeah. But like the BioShock games have never been good at bosses.
No.
And that's true in all of them. Like, that is true.
Except for Big Daddies.
Well, Big Daddies aren't really bosses.
They're like optional elective bosses.
Yeah, they're like...
Who were the bosses in BioShock? The only one I remember is the final boss.
Yeah, that's Fontaine.
And it was awful. Then in number two, they get rid of... They have Big Sisters, which are cool. And then they have just like a big, you know, rush of people. Like, they don't do an M-boss. But... yeah, none of the bosses in this game, I think, are very, very good, since 75% of them are Ghost Mom.
Yeah.
And the other one is a big rush of people. It's a tower defense thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Belias, that you forgot it. It's the worst thing.
Yeah, you spend 45 minutes on it, buddy.
Are you talking about when you control Songbird?
No, the Hand of the Prophet. It's the worst.
Wait, what's the Hand of the Prophet?
The ship. The ship at the end.
You just where you jump on the rails and you run.
I apologize to everybody listening for turning into a lemon grab, but unacceptable.
Wait,
oh my God.
Are you talking about where you control Songbird?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Jesus Christ, when your ship has a life bar?
Okay, yeah, no. Yeah, I understood that.
That part's bad.
Dennis said when you control Songbird, and you said no. Okay.
Okay.
I like the fact that you controlled Songbird. That was really cool.
I mean, okay.
You
but...
need to do it about. You need to be able to do it about three times more often than you could.
Yeah.
To make that bearable.
Yeah. That struck me as a point where they should have kind of done the Half-Life 2 and just let you take a victory lap and just like Songbird in as much as you want and annihilate.
Yes.
Things.
Oh yes.
Or alternatively, like programmed an encounter that required, you know, would have been more tactically sound and required Songbird and like, or made an interesting enemy as opposed to the other four like enemies in the game. Like, I would never argue that was supposed to be hard, but as a climactic gameplay experience, it's trash.
Thank God.
I mean, even narratively, like, you settle everything, it's just inertia. Like, and even calls it out, like, oh, we couldn't stop this, so it kept on going, and it's up to you to stop this. Like, you are resolving narrative inertia at this point.
Never a good thing in the character.
They keep sending the same people over and over again. Like,
Jesus
you fight
Christ.
The exact same wave like eight times.
Yeah,
like,
well, I mean, even back to the Lady Comstock fight. Like, you're just fighting dudes who revive, and you're chasing them around. Like, it's kind of weird because it mirrors Point Prometheus, and then it goes on way too long. But like, you're going around Emporia trying to find her, and just kind of like, oh, will her footprint show up? I don't know. Like, okay, there are these little bits of like finding these truths about the Lutesses. All right, fine, okay. But like the fight is just unacceptable.
See,
by the way,
can I
just call out one specific of that area that really made me like raise my eyebrows is in one of the shops in that area when you're tracking down Lady Constock and the truths has a random shop owner lady with like a broom sweeping up and like rambling incoherent things. Did you guys come across that?
Because she was killed in one reality.
Yeah, she's a reconciliation sickness victim.
Right? She's the only person that does that other than like the enemies in the game. Like, she's the only like just straight up NPC that does that. And so, it was really like just confusing why they had one of those.
So here's my question to you guys. Anybody with reconciliation sickness, you kill them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, also, why doesn't everyone have reconciliation sickness?
Yeah.
Like, is there you know, most of these people in infinite realities, not one version of them is dead.
Yeah. So I think the way, because I had a problem with this too, but I think what it is like whenever you have competing memories of right. two of your existences, that's when you start getting the sickness.
Yeah. How would the regular, like, I understand how Booker gets that because he goes through tears and stuff, yeah. but how would the regulars get it?
So it'd be
I would
tear.
Say because Elizabeth is there would be my I don't think that's necessarily a good answer, but yeah. I guess I would argue that Elizabeth effectively brings her reality with her.
There's something that implies adjacence, which is kind of mm-hmm. weird.
Like yeah, how big are the tears that you're going through? Because I could see like the tear, you know, it's she opens up this globe that you go through, but maybe when she opens that up, it's, you know, it's big enough that it encompasses the soldiers near you.
Yeah.
But again, it was just really random because it's always either the soldiers or you having it. And then just randomly, this lady sweeping the shop is there.
Yeah.
And there's never anything else like that in the rest of the game.
Yeah.
It was like some dude's, you know, 10% passion time project that he really wanted to have. And they just let Jim have it because they didn't want to talk.
Mess that lady up, dude. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of good.
I was going to say why the Latuses didn't have it, why the male Latuse did not have it, like, throughout the game.
Well, he did.
Because he was in – do you see him with a nosebleed?
In the Vox logs, they talk about he had it, but basically over time overcame it the same way Booker did.
Yeah.
But I don't think
No,
Booker, I think –
yeah, that's his yeah. whole – because they discuss, like, he's the one who – ultimately came up with the explanation of what was going on with the yep. whole, like, backfilling in memories and stuff like that.
Rosalind soothed Robert with song.
What?
With what?
Yeah. That is something that is explained explicitly in a Voxophone, which is, what? You know, Rosalind is the – or sorry, Robert is the one who was brought in. He is the foreigner in this yep. – he is the stranger in the strange land, and Rosalind was the one who soothed him into sticking around. Through his reconciliation sickness.
Yeah, but I don't think they found a way to cure the reconciliation sickness. When Comstock sabotaged their machine, it scattered them across dimensions, and that
right.
took care
well,
of it.
I mean, that put them above it was
yeah,
the way that I read it.
That's a yeah. better way to say it. Yep. Yeah.
Right. But, yeah. But I think it's actually somewhat implied that one potential motive behind them is him trying to recover his reconciliation. Conciliation sickness, but that's getting way back at the beginning of this conversation,
or at the end of it, I guess.
Yeah.
try
I mean,
try to
the same.
You know, bring back the girl and settle the debt, right?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. But
the other complaint that I want to lobby at this area, which is we're now in, I guess it's not Emporia.
Yeah, it's Emporium. I mean, so we're talking about going like Emporia into the Comstock house
pre like Ghost Lady fight. Pre-ghost mom.
Yeah, good ghost mom. Yeah.
But yeah, there's two branching paths, two ways you can go. And, you know, generally this game has exploration areas, but it's very on rails. So I started down one path and got pretty far into it. And then decided like, oh, okay, so this must be the main way. I'll go back and check the other way. And then got really far into that one. And basically found out at the very end of it, after doing a lot of backtracking, that it was all one big loop.
Yeah.
And so I had already cleared out the entire graveyard with Ghost Mom, pre being able to access Ghost Mom. And it's really awkward because they have, you know, like her grave right there. And you would think that Elizabeth would be interested in like going and doing something about it.
Yeah.
And the bars in front of her grave are exactly like the ones that, you know, she can fit through and you can't, which again happens like once in the entire game and then they never use it again.
Yeah.
But it just, you know, super, super weird and a lot of backtracking and wasted time.
Even bigger than that. Like, even though Elizabeth is not Lady Comstock's daughter, why does she like imprint on all the sensors that say it's her?
Because Elizabeth brings her, when they force Elizabeth to bring something in, it's based on her emotions or her concept of that thing. So at that point, I think she still believes that Lady Comstock is her mom.
Yeah, it's fast and loose like fast and loose like my stools after Oktoberfest. Like, come on, dudes. Like, come on.
You're really in love with this Fast and Loose like Stools reference here.
Yeah. No, it's I mean I'm also moving it forward. So
Yeah. Is that a euphemism for taking a number two?
You're moving it forward? Yeah, movements. Yeah. So I didn't mean to get gross,
moving
but
out California way.
Yeah, you move out California way. Oh man, okay. But yeah, Comstock House guys. Like just the notion that you're passing through this tear that future Elizabeth opens for you.
That this got off the rails. Like
it's probably my it's favorite off the part rails. Of the game.
I mean, it's great. Like I love it tonally. Like the part of me that can turn off the sensor that looks for things that don't make sense loves this. Yeah. Like the Children of Silence and such.
Yeah, but how does she go through time?
Like everything, it is the one Elizabeth who has gotten to the point where Comstock has groomed her to be the new prophet and recognizes that, this is bad. And again, she can't resolve this because it has gone on of its own inertia. And so she, brings you forward through it. I don't know how this Booker got through, except maybe this is the one Elizabeth who could open the tear to get him past the songbird to get the secret four notes, Gary.
Oh, hold on.
Thank you. To make it happen. But this is, again, the one of infinite who was able to move things forward, right?
I guess.
It's a contrivance. Like, it is admittedly a contrivance.
So this felt like, when you get into Comstock House, it feels like you're getting towards the end of the game. And then it opens you up into the Comstock prison, which is a whole new section introducing, new enemies. And I actually liked the new, siren head guys that it introduces.
Those guys terrify me.
Oh, it's great. Because there's this jump scare. Yeah.
See,
yeah.
The funny thing with that, maybe it was just me, I knew he was behind me. Like, I get done with that, and I'm like, oh, he's behind me, isn't he? Partially because they do that several times in Bioshock. But the funny thing is, I then turn around and still jump. How the heck does that work?
It was my second goddamn playthrough through the game. I knew he was there, but I still jumped. I was like, goddamn!
I don't know what it is, but just that character design is excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they look great.
The sound they make is so unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that they can run through tears.
Afar, because I was so scared to get near them.
Oh, I stealth it. I thought the stealth was good because I never actually got caught. Yeah. I have no reference for what happens when things go south. So
it's horrifying narratively because earlier Elizabeth says, hey, are you afraid of God? Because all of this has been about God so far. But then it becomes, no, actually, I'm afraid of you. And the fact that you're encountering these enemies who can run through tears themselves, like this has bled out. We talked about off the rails. Like everything is off the rails at this point because Prophet, Elizabeth Comstock has led this thing to happen.
Yeah, but at that point it was all like hyperdimensional soup to me. I had been trying to really to follow and make sense of things, and I think the prison was the point where I just kind of unfocused my eyes and was like, okay, it's gonna be whatever you say, dude.
Mm-hmm. See, what didn't make sense about that?
I can draw a line through it if I stop and think about it, but it was just so off the rails is the wrong word. So many, okay, now we're going through so many tears and now we're getting to future Elizabeth.
Yeah, what you're looking for.
Yeah.
It's introducing so many new elements so quickly that I have to stop caring about it. Like I can't really examine any of the new. It's like a 2-year-old bringing me their toys. Look at this, and look at this, and look at this, and it just I got fatigued.
I saw it as recontextualizing elements that were already there. Like, oh, it's a 2-year-old bringing you the toys, and like, hey, this is a toy gun. This ruins people's lives.
I think they're able to bring it back quickly enough because immediately after you see her, you're sent back to the moment where it got off the rails, where the songbird took Elizabeth.
Sure. I don't know.
Did you guys catch what year it was?
1960.
1984.
What?
During the bombing.
Yeah, oh, wow. During the bombing, it's 1984.
Well, where is that? Because I thought it was 60 because I thought everything related back to Bioshock.
No, it's in New York.
New York.
Huh. Yeah.
It's when the Zeppelins are
Because the Twin Towers are there. Yeah. Okay.
Anemic air defense. Mm. Like, what will the United States do against Zeppelins? How will we fight against this 100-year-old technology?
To be fair, by this point, she has god powers and is preparing to destroy the rest of the multiverse.
Well, that's weird. Has she been let loose from the siphon?
Zeppelins.
Yeah.
You just see Zeppelins.
Yeah.
Again, this is the point where you just really, I had to unfocus my eyes to continue enjoying the game.
The whole purpose of...
I agree. Too complicated.
See, the whole purpose of a time travel narrative is because it's fun to try to map all of it out. Like, yeah. Otherwise, that's the only reason to do time travel.
So maybe if you did time travel only, or maybe if you did multiple universes only, but when you...
Maybe if you... Both.
Yeah, and again, if you're doing multiple universes, you're by default doing time travel. So maybe what I'm trying to say is, if this is a time travel thing, great, then, you know, I can follow. Like I said earlier, when you get to the multiple universes, I think that just strips things of their meaning.
I know. To me, that's the whole playoff for playing this game. On the other hand, to be fair, I did not sleep last night and was up all night trying to figure this out. So
yeah, I mean, you know, it is inherently trying to pull punches. So, And this is a pretty big punch. Like when you see New York being bombed, and it's the exact same dream that you had at the beginning, like, oh, you made this happen, or like you couldn't stop it from happening.
And you see old Elizabeth.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the real emotional punch, is the fact that she spent her entire life waiting for you and just slowly lost hope.
Yeah,
and
heartbreak is a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a monster. It did not land for me.
It totally landed for me. Like, just, I mean, and like, to be granted, like, they didn't hit it with an especially light touch.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
there was no point at which I did not know that I was going to meet future Elizabeth. Like, the second she got stolen away and I couldn't immediately follow her, I was like, well, I am going to, you know, go through a fighting area and meet old Elizabeth.
And also, it's winter now.
Yeah.
Well, also, Dennis, I think that I'm picking up on, that you were a little bit just kind of fatigued. Like, I think that when you're talking about the two-year-old toy thing, like, that applies to all of your attention. Like, if you can't gerrymander your brain properly in order to like I'm going to pay attention to the characters but also let this stuff, you know, like you only have two sets of eyes to unfocus, you know. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like,
wait, I have two sets of eyes,
or one set of two eyes, one set of eyes to unfocus,
and then a third eye that sees all.
You know, like I it had a punch for me, but I also at the same time, like, was having a hard time with everything else, where I was like, do I care anymore? Like, what is this even about? What is the, you know, at that point I was so lost. Like, I feel like I understand the plot. Like, I don't feel like I don't get what happened. Mm-hmm. I feel like I get what happened. It's just whether I feel like it is sound or a good story to tell. Yeah. Like, there's, you know, theming I think is amazing. Like, wonderful themes, wonderful moments, but as a, like, the difference between, like, lore and story, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the lore is very cool. The story itself, like, it is an intentional act of, you know, kind of subversion with them taking, you know, it's trying to disorient you like that, you know? Yeah. Like,
and I wonder... go ahead.
Or I was just going to say, like, it wants you to... It's part of the reason why it's changing all the set dressing and clearing the table constantly is so you'll focus on Booker and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Like, so it can have this moment. Like, it's trying to make all that stuff blurry.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I wonder if it's more forgivable in the video game format that the story makes no sense, and if the themes and the moment to moment are strong. Like, that is, you know, I think that is more supportable in a video game setting than in any other medium.
For any number of reasons, you're 100% right. Yeah. Like, not least of which because of our lowered standards for video games. You know?
Well, not even counting that,
But also that, I mean, plot has never really mattered that much. I mean, what matters is story.
Yeah.
Well, I did really appreciate that it did seem like this was something that a game hadn't tried as hard to do this sort of thing before. Or at least this was one of the first games that I feel like really tried to be good science fiction and kind of push your understanding of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But
cool.
And you don't typically see that in like a AAA sort of game. So
yeah. So I mean, like, we praise things so often for going small, And like the idea that this starts with racial injustice and then goes down to like what is the complicated multidimensional relationship between these two people, like you know, the fact that it draws everything back to this small level, you know, is, you know, potentially laudable, except for the fact that it tries to simultaneously be as small as possible, two people, right? And mm-hmm. as big as possible, which is an infinite number of possible universes around this kind of thing. And I think that that is where a lot of my dissonance comes from, which is like it ends on this note of like, okay, we need to bring it back to this one point where like you and I never meet, except, you know, it also brings this other stuff in. Like it expands and contracts way too rapidly to not crack.
Mm-hmm. Although, yeah. Could some of that be the, you know, the variables and constants, whereas the constant is the two people and the variables are the infinite, universes?
I mean, like, maybe, but not successfully.
Yeah, that can be true, but it's also still important what they're choosing to show to us and how much time we're focusing on it and how it's constructed as a story. Like, that is an interpretation that could be factually true, but what is also worth considering other than what is actually true is how much time did I spend on this? What is being emphasized by the storyteller here? You know, how are these, where are we focusing our plot beats? Like, all of those things, I think, are what we're saying doesn't, you know, or what I'm saying, at least, I don't want to speak for anyone, like, doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, just because it can be logically, you can square the circle, doesn't mean that, like, it still works as a story. Yeah. You know, like, you can Mad Lib in things that make it work like a math problem, but that doesn't make it do all of the things that a story can magically do when it, everything kind of works, like being greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think absolutely the intent was that the constant was Booker and Elizabeth, and that the you know, the variables were meant to complement them. But I think what wound up happening is that instead of complementing them, you kind of got just, they gave you whiplash and made it harder to focus on them.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, and just, you know, they play it up like as you go into the, you know, the hand of the, you know, the hand of the prophet. And I don't think any of us can say that's not bullshit. Like, speak now or forever hold your peace. But like, we're going to ridicule you if you come out in defense of that.
In defense,
you're talking
which?
Specifically at the boss fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was the. Yeah.
I mean, like. Just the fact,
not as bad as a lot of BioShock's gameplay elements, but it was still really bad.
I mean, yeah, like in terms of the Vita chambers, or go ahead, Ben. Sorry,
they just needed to not make it so monotonous, and yeah,
or to make it good.
They just needed to do something different from the rest of the enemies that you fought, you know, up until that point, because it was just a rehashing of that. But then. Mm-hmm. They didn't stop doing it for a while, so that's what made it annoying, you know?
Or to make it the only point in the story when you had a failure state.
Yeah. Yeah. Did anyone get to the point where they lost health on their ship?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I got like, down to, like, a fifth.
No, but I mean, did you actually fail it?
Like, I had several game overs on this.
No, I did not.
But it forces you to restart.
Yeah.
That's some bullshit.
Yeah. That's the bullshit part of that. But, like... Fortunately, it opens up into, like, nice. There's a little bit of resolution to what's brought to you after you get past that. Good.
The resolution, so again, just a grand question to people, you know, while I have a court of people who have played this game. Like, I think that most people can agree that the ending is at least interesting and ambitious and everything, the actual ending, which I really liked. But does it – how important is it with everything that we've done up until that point? Like, even, you know, in the grand view, but even the specific, like, boss battle thing, like, I guess this is kind of dovetails into the question I asked before, but, like, how is that very cool thing served by what I've just spent the last hour doing before it?
Oh, the boss battle, I think the only good that can be said about the boss battle was getting back to the action so that you could... get a little get some whiplash and, you know, build up to, you know, him, you know, kind of overreacting and taking out Comstock and some of that. Yeah. But I feel like that could have been better served either just like by throwing a bunch of easy guys at you and letting you work off some steam with some executions or a more interesting boss battle.
It posits this thing. I'm sorry, Cole. I apologize. I just, I'll say this real quick and then I'll let you pop in. Yeah. But it posits this thing that I feel like the game is really trying to be about as a dessert. for things you have to sit through. And that's a mistake.
I would agree.
The game isn't about that. Like, what you spend a lot of the game doing, the game is not about. You know, the game is about this thing at the end. But you spend so much time and so much real estate doing this other thing that they don't care about, and I grew not to care about. And that's bad. Like, that's not really, that's not a mark of strength in a piece of art.
I think it is it's kind of like the opposite end of the Arkham series, where it's like all the battles are like the high points, and it's fun to go from each of those to the next one. But whereas this one, it's like, yeah, it's definitely kind of like the filler to get between all the great personal moments of, you know, on Battleship Bay or in the town outside of the Hall of Heroes.
I'll be very careful in the way I state this, because I feel like it, you know, draws very close to my personal interpretation of the relationship between Booker and Comstock. And, you know, it does attempt and faint to reconcile, you know, the actions that you've taken up to this point, which are, you know, this entire narrative is about guilt and the idea that you can't run away from yourself, in my own kind of like personal like headcanon or whatever goofy interpretation when applied to this, making it hyper personal or whatever. But, you know, just the idea that, you know, ultimately Booker and Comstock are the same person. And the only difference was this one moment where one decided to say no and become a much worse person through an easy way out versus, you know, becoming maybe a slightly better person through a much harder way out. And both of them start from the same place, which was this horrible violence that they kind of like started at. Right. And so
I think it's bad that I can't tell which one you're describing between the saying no and the person saying yes.
Yeah. So Comstock said yes to the baptism and said, you know what? I'm going to take this thing that says I will be a new person after it. Except instead, there was this flawed version. Both of them are entirely flawed and, you know, fatally so at the end. But, you know, Comstock was like, okay, I'm going to say yes to this, and therefore I will be impervious to any sin afterward, as revealed by the fact that Comstock said, I'm a prophet but not a god, therefore I don't have to forgive you. Whereas Booker was like, you know, I'm going to say no to this and say no to the easy rebirth and instead try and be a better person through kind of what amounts to attrition. But neither of us can change who exactly we are. And everything comes down to the singular moment where an infinite number of Comstocks and an infinite number of Bookers were born. And in all of the scenarios that you saw so far, there was a Comstock who said, yes, let's create this society where everybody less than me is oppressed. And there was a Booker who said, yes, anybody who is in my way will become a bloody pulp. And, you know, like, just in order to make sure neither of those existed, and, you know, both Booker and Comstock, both of whom were people who gave up their daughters, you know, never committed that sin to begin with, you know, stop that before it began. They ultimately had to die before that happened. Right. And so, like, that is the moment where all of these infinite possibilities were brought back together in a way that, you know, maybe kind of possibly in a personal way to satisfactorily brought it back together. In so far as this entire narrative to me is about guilt and the way that there are no easy answers and we're ultimately the people we set out to be, regardless of what we ultimately choose to do. And that is, you know, my finishing point for this Saturday in a Jerry Springer-esque fashion.
I guess I'd see, you know, the reason he had to die was, to avoid one of the constants, right?
Yeah. The constant was him, regardless, anyway, and always down the line.
Well, and what I would say is, at least my understanding was, the core problem was that it was a constant that at the baptism, if the baptism went through, since either option would go, there would always be an evil. There would always be a Comstock, because that would always be one that was generated. Therefore, the only way to eliminate that was to eliminate the choice itself.
Yeah, right? There would always be a yes, and there would always be a no. There would always
therefore
be a Comstock who would
ask the question.
Yeah, there would always be a Booker to give away Anna, and there would always be a Comstock to take Anna away.
Right.
Yeah, but I guess, again, not to be the Debbie Downer, but that means you could have killed him at any point before the baptism. And so they try to do this big head fake of like, oh, you know, we got to kill him at birth, but then, you know, kill him at rebirth or, you know, and it's just like literally any point in that chain works just fine.
Yeah, but that was the latest, possibly, to like spare him. Right. Like that was after he had committed the sins that he would want to try to atone for. So as opposed to killing a baby, you were killing somebody who had, you know, committed a massacre.
Oh, okay. So we can feel better about it.
Yeah.
Plus, I would say smothering a baby would not be a good ending piece to a game.
Yeah. We're so edgy, to be sure.
So edgy.
Well, I mean, also, you know, you watch after the cutscene, or after the credits, where the final cutscene implies that he, one, has the possibility to try again, and two, has at least some memory of the events that happened before, which leads to the at least somewhat likelihood that he actually will choose differently this time.
Hmm. Which time? One of the infinite times?
Yeah.
Well,
I like the idea. I like the spin on it that somehow collapses all these infinite possibilities into one final possibility. Mm-hmm. One final true dimension. That is what the DLC springs from. I hadn't heard that idea before, and I like that. Mm-hmm. But that's getting into the next part.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Gary. I feel like you have something to say about this.
No. I mean, I feel like I don't disagree with you. I just think that the theming I've never had a problem with mm-hmm. in this game. Like, I think that you're correct. Yeah. I think that is part of what it's about. I just think that it does a shitty job of expressing it. And mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time on things that are not integral to the theme, you know?
Final thoughts on Bioshock Infinite, having not played Burial at Sea.
So recalling, I think one of the first texts I sent out after beating the game is I was just happy that this had pushed video games forward as a medium mm-hmm. and had a narrative that could rival something like Inception as far as being complex and interesting and engaging. So yeah, so that was one thing that I really liked about it. I will see the point that the combat system was a lateral move from the first game. That was not, I guess, the focal point when I was playing it. So it is a shame that was kind of perhaps a missed opportunity, that there wasn't more there. But, you know, I still very much appreciate the story. So I was at least happy with that.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, to sum up your thing in an unfair way, hijacking your point, it's an interesting mental playground. Mm-hmm. But, like, what consequence that is of is really up to the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Words.
Spoken in the most douchebaggery way possible. So I am very sorry for that.
Now you know.
You're such a pretty bird, but it's a pity bird. Your cage you have outgrown, but I know something, bird. The time is right, bird, to break these chains and go and fly away. Hey.
It is very late here tonight when we're recording this, so I'm going to bring this episode to a close. The music that you're hearing right now is by the band Shiny and the Spoon. This is a song called Canary in the Coal Mine. It is not in any way featured in Bioshock Infinite, but it is thematically appropriate, and the people who make this song are my friends. Is there anything we can do? Well, you can leave us a rating or review on iTunes. Let us know via duckfeed.tv/contact if you would like us to do any more of these bonus level kind of things, bringing more people in.
And you don't have a choice. There will be more.
Yeah, exactly. So, I just want to know how frequently you want us to do these. Patreon, if you want to support the network in a very direct monetary way, it is patreon.com/duckfeedtv. And in general, you can follow us on iTunes. I am Cole Ross, at Cole Ross on Twitter.
I am Dennis Furia, at D Furia on Twitter.
I'm David Moneysmith, at MySmith777 on Twitter.
Does Ben go last in this too?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. I'm Gary Butter, Gary Buh, GARYBUH.
And I'm Ben Merkel at Merkelizer on Twitter.
Yeah. And Ben, can we button it up?
Please.
Okay.
Would you kindly
close the tear, Cole?
Just get to it, Bird. You're on your own, Bird. The world is yours to tame. But don't you know it, Bird, that once you're free, Bird, you'll find you just fall right into a pit.